Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're extremely honored today to be joined by Chris's brave and loving wife, Taya. Please give her a warm welcome.
Thank you. Like many young boys, Chris and his brother Jeff developed a sense of justice through playing in the outdoors. They used their pretend rifles, fighting imaginary bad guys, copying the heroes they saw in John Wayne movies. Those early battles nurtured a strong desire to protect others from evil and fight for what was right. As he got older, Chris's parents were adamant about teaching the importance of gun safety and proper use of real guns. He began to respect firearms as tools that could bring as much harm as good. When he learned to safely shoot and hunt, he was taught only to kill what he needed for food. He developed an appreciation of guns as a means of providing nourishment while exploring the peaceful essence of nature with his family. In the short amount of time after Chris got out of the military, he found himself reflecting on how guns affected the many aspects of American history. In doing so, he developed an idea for a book coming out this June called American Gun. In it, Chris chose to tell the stories of 10 iconic guns and the people who used them, altering the course of United States history, from the Revolutionary Wars to the Western Frontier, World Wars, and beyond. As I helped finish American Gun after his death, I reflected on how they have played a role in my life, too. I pray they will continue to, as I am all too aware of the existence of evil in all walks of life. And because of that, I want to thank you and those who came before you for standing strong in defending our right to bear arms. Thank you for understanding the difference between the use of guns in terrorizing innocent people in our country and abroad, and the use of guns in protecting against an evil that will not be reasoned with.
Context of white supremacy. Justice Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, January 2nd, 2015. So I have been told. The audio clip you heard at the beginning, the widow of our author, white killer Chris Kyle's wife, Taya Kyle. That was her speaking at the NRA convention in 2013. That was just a few months after Chris Kyle was shot and killed in February of 2013. Fascinating. You heard just a few snippets. The whole speech is about 20 minutes, but I thought those right there really cut to some crucial aspects. Again, this reverence for firearms. Fascinating. I thought of Tamir Rice so many times when she's talking about that. And they had photos, too, if you catch the video, of these little white children who are much younger than Tamir, who are holding what, to me, look like authentic firearms. and this is praised and celebrated, and just, wow, you are a real, true American, a hero, and a patriot for standing up in reverence of the gun. Dr. Welsing moment, phallic symbol all the way. We will get started. We're picking up right after 9/11. If you're looking, there are like subheadings in the book in between each chapter. So we're right after he was stopped by the enforcement official on 9/11 when he was reporting to his base. Should be training. That's what we're picking up at, that subheading. Definitely looking forward to hearing feedback. We will get started. Pay attention. Take notes. Chris Kyle, American sniper. Context of white supremacy.
Training. We were put on immediate standby, but it would turn out that we weren't needed in Afghanistan or anywhere else at that moment. My platoon would have to wait roughly a year before we got into action, and when we did, it would be against Saddam Hussein, not Osama bin Laden. There's a lot of confusion in the civilian world about SEALs and our mission. Most people think we're strictly sea-based commandos, meaning that we always operate off ships and hit targets on the water or on the immediate coastline. Admittedly, a fair amount of our work involves things at sea. We're in the Navy, after all. And from a historical perspective, as briefly mentioned earlier, SEALs trace their origins to the Navy's underwater demolition teams, or UDTs. Established during World War II, UDT frogmen were responsible for reconning beaches before they were hit, and they trained for a variety of other waterborne tasks, such as infiltrating harbors and planting limpet mines on enemy ships. They were the mean, badass combat divers of World War II and the post-war era, and SEALs are proud to carry on in their wake. But as the UDT mission expanded, the Navy recognized that the need for special operations didn't end at the beach line. As new units called SEALs were formed and trained for this expanded mission, they came to replace the older UDT units. While land may be the final word in the SEAL acronym, it's hardly the last thing we do. Every special operations unit in the U.S. military has its own specialty. There's a lot of overlap in our training, and the range of our missions is similar in many respects, but each branch has its own expertise. Army Special Forces, also known as SF, does an excellent job training foreign forces, both in conventional and unconventional warfare. Army Rangers are a big assault force, and if you want a large target, say an airfield taken down, that's their thing. Air Force Special Operators, parajumpers, excel at pulling people out of the shit. Among our specialties are DAs. DA stands for Direct Action. A direct action mission is a very short, quick strike against a small but high-value target. You might think of it as a surgical strike against the enemy. In a practical sense, it could range from anything like an attack on a key bridge behind enemy lines to a raid on a terrorist hideout to arrest a bomb maker, a snatch and grab, as some call it. While those are very different missions, the idea is the same. Strike hard and fast before the enemy knows what's going on. After 9/11, SEALs began training to deal with the places Islamic terrorists were most likely to be located, Afghanistan, number one, and then the Middle East and Africa. We still did all the things a SEAL is supposed to do, diving, jumping out of planes, taking down ships, etc. But there was more emphasis on land warfare during our workup than there traditionally had been in the past. There was a debate about this shift far above my pay grade. Some people wanted to limit SEALs to 10 miles inland. Nobody asked my opinion, but as far as I'm concerned, there shouldn't be any limits. Personally, I'm just as happy to stay out of the water, but that's beside the point. Let me do what I'm trained to do wherever it needs to be done. The training, most of it anyway, was fun, even when it was a kick in the balls. We dove, we went into the desert, we worked in the mountains. We even got waterboarded and gassed. Everybody gets waterboarded during training. The idea is to prepare you in case you're captured. The instructors tortured us as hard as they could, tying us up and pounding on us, just short of permanently damaging us. They say each of us has a breaking point, and that prisoners eventually give in. But I would have done my best to make them kill me before I gave up secrets. Gas training was another kick. Basically, you get hit with CS gas and have to fight through it. CS gas is captor spray or tear gas. The active ingredient is 2-chlorobenzyl melanonitrile for all of you chemistry majors. We thought of it as cough and spit because that's the best way to deal with it. You learn during training to let your eyes run. The worst thing to do is rub them. You're going to get snotty, and you're going to be coughing and crying, but you can still shoot your weapon and fight through it. That's the point of the exercise. We went up to Kodiak, Alaska, where we did a land navigation course. It wasn't the height of winter, but there was still so much snow on the ground that we had to put on snowshoes. We started with basic instruction on keeping warm, layering up, etc., and learned about things like snow shelters. One of the important points of this training, which applied everywhere, was learning how to conserve weight in the field. You have to figure out whether it's more important to be lighter and more mobile, or to have more ammunition and body armor. I prefer lightness and speed. I count ounces when we go out, not pounds. The lighter you are, the more mobile you become. The little bastards out there are faster than hell. You need every advantage you can get on them. The training was pretty competitive. We found out at one point that the best platoon in the team would be shipped out to Afghanistan. Training picked up from that point on. It was a fierce competition, and not just out on the training range. The officers were backstabbing each other. They'd go to the CO and dime each other out. Did you see what those guys did on the range? They're no good. The competition came down to us and one other platoon. We came in second. They went to war. We stayed home. That's about the worst fate a SEAL can imagine. With the conflict in Iraq looming on the horizon, our emphasis shifted. We practiced fighting in the desert. We practiced fighting in cities. We worked hard, but there were always lighter moments. I remember one time we were on a rut, real urban training. Our command would find a municipality that was willing to have us come in and take down an actual building, an empty warehouse, say, or a house. Something a little more authentic than you would find on a base. On this one exercise, we were working at a house. Everything had been carefully arranged with the local police department. A few actors had been recruited to play parts during the exercise. My role was to pull security outside. I blocked out traffic, waving vehicles away as some of the local cops watched from the sidelines. While I was standing there, gun out, not looking particularly friendly, this guy walked down the block toward me. I started going through the drill. First, I waved him off. He kept coming. Then I shined my light on him. He kept coming. I put my laser dot on him. He kept coming. Of course, the closer he got, the more convinced I was that he was a role player sent to test me. I mentally reviewed my ROEs, rules of engagement, which covered how I was supposed to act. "What are you, the Po-Po?" he asked, sticking his face out toward mine. Po-po, a thug's term for police, wasn't in the ROEs, but I figured he was ad-libbing. The next thing on my list was to throw him down, so I did. He started to resist and reached under his jacket for what I assumed was a weapon, which is exactly what a SEAL playing a bad guy would do. So I reacted in kind, giving a good SEAL response as I wrestled him into the dirt and busted him up a bit. Whatever was under his jacket broke, and liquid went everywhere. He was cussing and carrying on, but I didn't take the time to think about all that just then. As the fight ran out of him, I cuffed him and looked around. The cops, seated in their patrol car nearby, were just about doubled over laughing. I went over to see what was up. "That's so-and-so," they told me, "one of the biggest drug dealers in the city. We wish we could have beat him just like you did." Apparently, Mr. Po-Po ignored all the signs and wandered into the training exercise, figuring he'd carry on business as usual. There are idiots everywhere. But I guess that explains how he got into that line of work in the first place. Hazed and hitched. For months, the United Nations Security Council pressured Iraq to comply fully with UN resolutions, especially those requiring inspections of suspected weapons of mass destruction and related sites. War wasn't a foregone conclusion. Saddam Hussein could have complied and shown inspectors everything they wanted to see, but most of us knew he wouldn't. So when we got the word that we were shipping out to Kuwait, we were excited. We figured we were going to war. One way or the other, there was plenty to do out there. Besides watching Iraq's borders and protecting the Kurdish minority, who Saddam had gassed and massacred in the past, U.S. troops were enforcing no-fly zones in the north and south. Saddam was smuggling oil and other items both into and out of his country in violation of the U.N. sanctions. The U.S. and other allies were stepping up operations to stop that. Before we deployed, Taya and I chose to get married. The decision surprised both of us. One day we were talking in the car, and we both came to the conclusion that we should get married. The decision stunned me, even as I made it. I agreed with it. It was completely logical. We were definitely in love. I knew she was the woman I wanted to spend my life with, and yet, for some reason, I didn't think the marriage would last. We both knew that there is an extremely high divorce rate in the SEALs. As a matter of fact, I've heard marriage counselors claim that it is close to 95%, and I believe it. So maybe that was what worried me. Perhaps part of me wasn't really ready to think about a lifetime commitment. And of course, I understood how demanding my job was going to be once we went to war. I can't explain the contradictions. But I do know that I was absolutely in love, and that she loved me. And so, for better or worse, make that peace or war, marriage was our next step together. Happily, we survived it all. One thing you ought to know about SEALs. When you're new to the teams, you get hazed. The platoons are very tight-knit groups. Newcomers, always called new guys, are treated like hell until they prove they belong. That usually doesn't happen until well into their first deployment, if then. New guys get the shit jobs. They're constantly tested. They're always beat on. It's a kind of an extended hazing that takes many forms. For example, on a training exercise, you work hard. The instructors kick your ass all day long. Then, when you're done, the platoon will go out and party. When we're out on a training mission, we usually drive around in large 12-passenger vans. A new guy always drives, which, of course, means he can't drink when we hit the bars, at least not to SEAL standards. That's the mildest form of hazing. In fact, it's so mild it's not really hazing. Choking him out while he's driving, that's hazing. One night soon after I joined my platoon, we were out partying after a training mission. When we left the bar, all the older guys piled into the back. I wasn't driving, but I had no problem with that. I like to sit up front. We were speeding along for a while, and all of a sudden I heard, 1, 2, 3, 4, I declare a van war. The next thing I knew, I was pummeled. Van war meant it was open season on the new guys. I came out of that one with bruised ribs and a black eye, maybe two. I must have gotten my lip busted a dozen times during hazing. I should say that van wars are separate from bar fights, another SEAL staple. SEALs are pretty notorious for getting into bar scrapes, and I was no exception. I've been arrested more than once through the years, though, as a general rule, the charges were either never filed or quickly dismissed. Why do SEALs fight so much? I haven't made a scientific study of it, but I think a lot is owed to pent-up aggression. We're trained to go out and kill people, and then at the same time we're also being taught to think of ourselves as invincible badasses. That's a pretty potent combination. When you go into a bar, you'll always have someone who will poke a shoulder into you or otherwise imply you should fuck off. Happens in every bar across the world. Most people just ignore things like that. If someone does that to a SEAL, we're going to turn and knock you out. But at the same time, I have to say that while SEALs end a lot of fights, we usually don't start many. In a lot of cases, the fights are the result of some sort of stupid jealousy or the need for a dumbass to test his own manhood and earn bragging rights for fighting a SEAL. When we go into bars, we don't just cower down in the corner or lay low. We go in extremely confident. Maybe we're loud. And with us being mostly young and in great shape, people take notice. Girls gravitate toward a group of SEALs. And maybe that makes their boyfriends jealous. Or guys want to prove something for some other reason. Either way, things escalate. And fights happen. But I wasn't talking about bar fights. I was talking about hazing and my wedding. We were in the Nevada mountains. It was cold, so cold that it was snowing. I had gotten a few days' leave to get married. I was due to take off in the morning. The rest of the platoon still had some work to do. We got back that night to our temporary base and went inside to the mission planning room. The chief told everybody that we'd relax and have a few beers while we mapped out the next day's operation. Then he turned to me. "Hey, new guy," he told me. "Go grab the beer and the booze out of the van and bring it in here." I hopped, too. When I came back in, everyone was sitting in chairs. There was only one left, and it was kind of in the middle of a circle of others. I didn't think too much about it as I sat down. "All right, this is what we're going to do," my chief said, standing in front of a dry erase board at the front of the room. "The operation will be an ambush. The target will be in the center. We will completely encircle it." That doesn't sound too smart, I thought. If we come in from every direction, we'll be shooting each other. Usually our ambushes are planned in an L shape to avoid that. I looked at the chief. The chief looked at me. Suddenly, his serious expression gave way to a shit-ass grin. With that, the rest of the platoon bum-rushed me. I hit the floor a second later. They cuffed me to a chair and then began my kangaroo court. There were a lot of charges against me. The first was the fact that I had let it be known that I wanted to become a sniper. "The new guy is ungrateful," thundered the prosecutor. "He does not want to do his job. He thinks he is better than the rest of us." I tried to protest, but the judge, none other than the chief himself, quickly ruled me out of order. I turned to my defense attorney. "What do you expect?" he said. "He's only got a third-grade education." "Guilty," declared the judge. "Next charge." "Your Honor, the defendant is disrespectful," said the prosecutor. "He told the CO to fuck off." "Objection," said my lawyer. "He told the OIC to fuck off." The CO is the commanding officer of the team. The OIC is the officer in charge of the platoon. A pretty big difference, except in this case. "Guilty. Next charge." For every offense I was found guilty of, which meant anything and everything they could make up, I had to take a drink of Jack Daniels and Coke, followed by a shooter of Jack. They got me pretty wasted before we even got to the felonies. At some point, they stripped me down and put ice down my drawers. Finally, I passed out. Then they spray-painted me and, for good measure, drew Playboy bunnies on my chest and back with a marker, just the sort of body art you want for your honeymoon. At some point, my friends apparently became concerned about my health, so they taped me to a spine board completely naked, took me outside, and stood me up in the snow. They left me for a while until I regained some amount of consciousness. By then, I was jackhammering hard enough to put a hole through a bunker roof. They gave me an IV, the saline helps cut down the alcohol in your system, and finally took me back to the hotel, still taped to the spine board. All I remember from the rest of the night is being lifted up a bunch of stairs, apparently to my motel room. There must have been a few spectators because the boys were yelling, "Nothing to see here, nothing to see," as they carried me in. Taya washed off most of the paint and the bunnies when I met up with her the next day, but a few were still visible under my shirt. I kept my jacket tightly buttoned for the ceremony. By then, the swelling in my face was almost completely gone. The stitches in my eyebrow, from a friendly fight among teammates a few weeks earlier, were healing nicely. The cut on my lip, from a training exercise, was also healing pretty well. Probably not every bride's dream to have a spray-painted, beat-up groom, but Taya seemed happy enough. The amount of time we had for our honeymoon, though, was a sore point. The team was gracious enough to give me 3 days to get hitched and honeymoon. As a new guy, I was appreciative of the brief leave. My new wife wasn't quite as understanding, and made that clear. Nonetheless, we married and honeymooned quickly. Then I got back to work. 3. Takedowns. Gun ready. "Wake up! We got a tanker!" I roused myself from the side of the boat where I'd been catching some rest, despite the cold wind and choppy waters. I was soaked from the spray. Despite the fact that I was a new guy on my first deployment, I'd already mastered the art of sleeping in all sorts of conditions, an unheralded but critical SEAL skill. An oil tanker loomed ahead. The helicopter had spotted it trying to sneak down the Gulf after loading up illegally in Iraq. Our job was to get aboard her, inspect her papers, and if, as suspected, she was violating the UN sanctions, turn her over to the Marines or other authorities for processing. I scrambled to get ready. Our RIB, rigid-hulled inflatable boat, used for a variety of SEAL tasks, looked like a cross between a rubber life raft and an open speedboat with two monster motors in the back. 36 feet long, it held 8 SEALs and hit upwards of 45 knots on a calm sea. The exhaust from the twin motors wafted over the boat, mixing with the spray as we gathered speed. We were hauling at a good pace, riding the wake of the tanker where radar couldn't pick us up. I went to work, taking a long pole from the deck of the boat. Our speed dropped as our RIB cut alongside the tanker until we were just about matching its pace. The Iranian ship's engines pulsed in the water, so loud our own motors were drowned out. As we pushed alongside the tanker, I extended the pole upward, trying to angle the grappling hook at the top onto the ship's rail. Once the hook caught, I jerked the pole down. Gotcha. A bungee cord connected the hook to the pole. A steel cable ladder was connected to the hook. Someone grabbed hold of the bottom and held it while the lead man began climbing up the side of the ship. A loaded oil tanker can sit fairly low in the water, so low, in fact, that you sometimes can just grab the rail and hop over. That wasn't the case here. The railing was quite a bit higher than our little boat. I'm not a fan of heights, but as long as I didn't think too much about what I was doing, I was fine. The ladder rocked with the ship and the wind. I pulled myself up as quickly as I could go, my muscles remembering all those pull-ups and buds. By the time I reached the deck, the lead guys were already headed toward the wheelhouse and bridge of the ship. I ran to catch up. Suddenly, the tanker began gaining speed. The captain, belatedly realizing he was being boarded, was trying to head for Iranian waters. If he reached them, we'd have to jump off. Our orders strictly forbade taking any ship outside of international waters. I got up to the head of the team just as they reached the door to the bridge. One of the crew got there at roughly the same time and tried to lock it. He wasn't fast enough, or strong enough. One of the boarding party threw himself against the door and bashed it open. I ran through, gun ready. We'd done dozens of these operations over the past few days, and rarely had anyone even hinted of resistance. But the captain of this ship had some fight in him, and even though he was unarmed, he wasn't ready to surrender. He made a run at me. Pretty stupid. First of all, I'm not only bigger than him, but I was wearing full body armor, not to mention the fact that I had a submachine gun in my hand. I took the muzzle of my gun and struck the idiot in his chest. He went right down. Somehow, I managed to slip as well. My elbow flew out and landed straight on his face. A couple of times. That pretty much took the fight out of him. I rolled him over and cuffed him. Boarding and searching ships, officially known as VBSS, for Visit, Board, Search, Seize, is a standard SEAL mission. While the regular Navy has specially trained sailors to handle the job in peacetime, we're trained to handle the searches in places where resistance is likely. And in the lead-up to war during the winter of 2002-2003, that meant the Persian Gulf off Iraq. The UN later estimated that in violation of international sanctions, billions of dollars of oil and other items were smuggled out of Iraq and into the pockets of Saddam's regime. Smuggling took on all sorts of forms. You'd find oil being carried in wheat carriers hidden in barrels. More commonly, tankers took on thousands and thousands of gallons in excess of what they were permitted in the UN Oil for Food program. It wasn't just oil. One of the biggest contraband shipments we came across that winter were dates. Apparently, they could fetch a decent price on the world market. It was during those first months of my first deployment that I became acquainted with the Polish Wojskowa Formacja Specjalna Grom im Sziszo Siemisz Spatoszraniarzy Armii Krajowej, Special Military Formation, GROM, of the Dark and Silent Parachutists of the Polish Army, better known as GROM. They're the Polish version of the Special Forces, with an excellent reputation in special operations, and they worked on the takedowns with us. Generally, we worked off a big ship, which we used as kind of a floating home port for our ribs. Half of the platoon would go out for one 24-hour period. We would sail to a designated spot and drift in the night, waiting. With luck, a helo or a ship would radio intel about a ship coming out of Iraq sailing pretty low in the water. Anything that had a cargo would be boarded and inspected. We'd go out and take it down. A few times we worked with a Mark V boat. The Mark V is a special operations craft that some people have compared to World War II-era PT boats. The craft looks like an armored speedboat, and its job is to get SEALs into harm's way as quickly as possible. Built out of aluminum, it can haul serious ass. The boats are said to hit 65 knots. But what we liked about them were their flat decks behind the superstructure. Ordinarily, we would load two Zodiacs back there. But since the Zodiacs weren't needed, the whole company would board from the ribs and stretch out to grab some sleep until ships were spotted. That beat leaning across the seat or twisting yourself around to rest on the gunwale. Taking down ships in the Gulf quickly became routine. We could take dozens in a night. But our biggest takedown didn't come off Iraq. It was some 1,500 miles away off the coast of Africa. Scuds. In late fall, a SEAL platoon in the Philippines snuck alongside a freighter named the Sosan. From that point on, the North Korean ship was literally a marked vessel. The 3,500-ton freighter had an interesting history of transporting items to and from North Korea. According to one rumor, she had transported chemicals that could be used to create nerve weapons. In this case, though, the Sosan's papers declared that she was carrying cement. What she was really carrying were Scud missiles. The ship was tracked around the Horn of Africa while the Bush administration decided what to do about it. Finally, the president ordered that the ship be boarded and searched, just the sort of job SEALs excel at. We had a platoon in Djibouti, which was a hell of a lot closer to the craft than we were, but because of the way the chain of command and assignments worked, the unit happened to be working from the Marines while we were directly under a Navy command. We were tasked to take down the freighter. You can imagine how happy our sister platoon was to see us when we landed in Djibouti. Not only had we stolen the mission they considered theirs, they had to suffer the indignity of helping us offload and get ready for action. As soon as I got off the plane, I spotted a buddy. "Hey," I shouted. "Fuck off," he answered. "What's up?" "Fuck you." That was the extent of his welcome. I couldn't blame him. In his place, I'd have been pissed myself. He and the others eventually came around. They weren't mad at us. They were mad at the situation. Grudgingly, they helped us prepare for the mission, then got us aboard a mail and resupply helicopter from the USS Nassau, an amphibious assault ship out in the Indian Ocean. Amphibs, as they were called, are large assault ships that carry troops and helicopters, and occasionally Marine Harrier attack aircraft. They look like old-fashioned aircraft carriers with a straight-through flight deck. They're fairly large and have command and control facilities that can be used as forward planning and command posts during assault operations. There are several ways to take down a ship, depending on the conditions and the target. While we could have used helicopters to get to the Sosan, looking at photos of the ship, we noticed that there were a number of wires running above the deck. Those wires would have to be removed before we could land, which would add time to the operation. Knowing we'd lose the element of surprise if we went in with helos, we opted to use ribs instead. We started doing practice runs off the side of the Nassau with boats that had been brought out there by a special boat unit. Special boat units are the SEALs' dedicated taxi service. They run the ribs, Mark V's, and other SEAL-related vessels. Among other things, the units are equipped and trained to make combat insertions, braving fire to get SEALs in and out of trouble. The Sosan, meanwhile, continued sailing toward us. We were geared up as it came within range, preparing to hit it. But before we could board the boats, we got a call telling us to stand by. The Spaniards had moved in. What? The Spanish frigate Navarra had confronted the Sosan, which had been fooling exactly nobody by sailing without a flag and with her name covered up. According to later reports, Spanish spec op troops went in after the freighter failed to comply with the frigate's orders to stop. Of course, they used helicopters and, just as we had thought, were delayed by having to shoot out the wires. From what I've heard, that delay would have given the captain aboard the vessel time to get rid of incriminating paperwork and other evidence. That's what I think happened. Obviously, there was a lot going on behind the scenes that we weren't aware of. Whatever. Our mission was quickly changed from taking down the ship to going aboard and securing it, and uncovering the Scud missiles. You wouldn't think missiles would be hard to find, but in this case, they were nowhere to be seen. The ship's hold was full of bags of cement, 80-pound bags. There must have been hundreds of thousands. There was only one place the Scuds could be. We started moving cement, bag after bag. That was our job for 24 hours. No sleep, just move bags of cement. I must have moved thousands myself. It was miserable. I was covered with dust. God knows what my lungs looked like. Finally, we found shipping containers underneath. Out came our torches and saws. I worked on one of the quickie saws, also known as a cutoff saw. It looks like a chainsaw with a circular blade on the front. It cuts through just about anything, including Scud containers. 15 Scud missiles lay under the cement. I'd never seen a Scud up close before, and to be honest, I thought they were kind of cool looking. We took pictures, then waved the EOD guys, explosives ordnance disposal or bomb disposal experts, in to make sure they were inert. By that point, the entire platoon was completely covered with cement dust. A few guys went over the side to clean off. Not me. Given my history with dives, I wasn't taking any chances. That much cement? Who the hell knows what happens when it touches the water? We handed the Sosan over to the Marines and went back aboard the Nassau. Command sent word that we would be pulled out and returned to Kuwait in the same expedient fashion you were brought in. Of course, they were full of shit. We stayed on the Nassau for 2 weeks. For some reason, the Navy couldn't figure out how to free up one of the umpteen helicopters they had sitting on the flight deck to get us back to Djibouti. So we played video games and pumped iron, waiting. That and slept. Unfortunately, the only video game we had with us was Madden Football. I got pretty good at it. Up until that time, I hadn't been much for playing video games. Now I'm an expert, especially at Madden. That was probably where I got hooked. I think my wife still cusses my 2 weeks aboard the Nassau to this very day. A note on the Scuds. The missiles were bound for Yemen, or at least that's what Yemen said. There have been rumors that they were part of some sort of a deal with Libya involving a payoff to take Saddam Hussein into exile, but I have no idea whether that's true or not. In any event, the Scuds were released and went on to Yemen. Saddam stayed in Iraq, and we went back to Kuwait to get ready for war. Christmas. That December was the first Christmas I'd ever been away from my family, and it felt a little depressing. The day kind of came and went without a memorable celebration. I do remember the presents Taya's folks sent that year, though. Remote control Hummers. They were small radio-controlled toys that were just a blast to drive around. Some of the Iraqis working on base had apparently never seen anything like them before. I'd drive a vehicle toward them and they would scream and bolt away. I don't know if they thought it was some sort of guided missile or what. Their high-pitched screams coupled with sprints in the opposite direction had me doubled over. Cheap thrills in Iraq were priceless. Some of the people we had working for us were not exactly the best of the best, nor were all of them particularly fond of Americans. They caught one jerking off into our food. He was quickly escorted from the base. The head shed, our command and officers, knew that as soon as everyone found out what he'd done, someone would probably try and kill him. We stayed at two different camps in Kuwait, Ali As-Salem and Doha. Our facilities at both were relatively bare bones. Doha was a large U.S. Army base and played important roles in both the first and what would be the second Gulf War. We were given a warehouse there and framed out rooms with the help of some Seabees, the Navy combat engineers. We'd come to rely on the Seabees for similar support in the future. Ali As-Salem was even more primitive, at least for us. There we got a tent and some shelving units. That was about it. I guess the powers that be figured SEALs don't need much. I was in Kuwait when I saw my first desert sandstorm. The day suddenly became night. Sand swirled everywhere. From the distance, you can see a vast orange-brown cloud moving toward you. Then, suddenly, it's black, and you feel like you're in the middle of a swirling mine shaft, or maybe the rinse cycle in a bizarre washing machine that uses sand instead of water. I remember being in an airplane hangar, and even though the doors were closed, the amount of dust in the air was unbelievable. The sand was a fine grit that you never wanted to get in your eyes because it would never come out. We quickly learned to wear goggles to protect them. Sunglasses wouldn't do. 60 Gunner. Being a new guy, I was the 60 Gunner. As I'm sure many of you know, 60 refers to the M60 General Purpose Machine Gun, a belt-fed weapon that has served the U.S. military in a number of versions for several decades. The M60 was developed in the 1950s. It fires 7.62mm bullets. The design is so flexible that it can be used as the basis for a coaxial machine gun in armored vehicles and helicopters, and a light man-carried squad-level weapon. It was a workhorse in the Vietnam War, where grunts called it the pig, and occasionally cursed over the hot barrel, which required an asbestos glove to change after firing a few hundred rounds. Not particularly convenient in combat. The Navy made substantial improvements to the weapon over the years, and it remains a potent gun. The newest version is so improved, in fact, that it rates a different designation. The Navy calls it a Mark 43 Mod Zero. Some contend it should be considered a completely separate weapon. I'm not going to wade into that debate. It's comparatively light, in the area of 23 pounds, and has a relatively short barrel. It also has a rail system, which allows scopes and the like to be attached. Also currently in service are M240s, M249s, and the Mark 26, a variant of the M249. As a general rule, the machine guns carried by shooters in my platoons were always called 60s, even when they were actually something else, like the Mark 48. We used more Mark 48s as time went on during my days in Iraq, but unless it's significant for some reason, I refer to any squad-level machine gun as a 60 and leave others to sort out the fine print. The old pig nickname for the 60 survives, which leads a lot of 60 gunners to be called pigs, or a creative variation. In our platoon, a friend of mine named Bob got tagged with it. It never applied to me. My nickname was Tex, which was one of the more socially acceptable things people called me. With war becoming inevitable, we began patrolling the border across Kuwait, making sure that the Iraqis weren't going to try and sneak across in a preemptory strike. We also began training for a role in the upcoming fight. That meant spending quality time in DPVs, also known as SEAL dune buggies. DPVs, desert patrol vehicles, look extremely cool from the distance, and they are far better equipped than your average ATV. There's a 50 caliber machine gun and a Mark 19 grenade launcher on the front, and an M60 on the back. Then there are the LAW rockets, one-shot anti-tank weapons that are the spiritual descendants of World War II bazookas and Panzerfausts. The rockets are mounted in special brackets on the tubular upper frame. Adding to the coolness factor is the SAT radio antenna on the very top of the vehicle, with a donkey dick radio antenna next to it. Practically every picture you see of a DPV has the sucker flying over a sand dune and popping a wheelie. It is an exceedingly badass image. Unfortunately, it is just that, an image, not a reality. From what I understand, the DPVs were based on a design that had been used in the Baja races. Stripped down, they were undoubtedly mean mothers. The problem is, we didn't drive them stripped down. All that ordnance we carried added considerable weight. Then, there were our rucks, and the water, and the food you need to survive in a desert for a few days. Extra gas, not to mention three fully equipped SEALs, driver, navigator, and pig gunner. and in our case, a Texas flag flying off the rear. Both my chief and I on what had happened.
Okay. Cows, Gusty Renegade. I was following along with the text, and it was not matching up where I was in the book. And I was thinking, one, I was really upset because I've said before I don't like doing the, like, sometimes they'll do audiobooks and they'll be abridged, and I absolutely hate those. I think Dreams from My Father, President Obama, I think that's the only time that we've done an abridged audiobook, and I remember how frustrating it was to read because I would get lost when they removed entire chapters sometimes and what they chose to remove from the book. So I was confused because I was like, wait a minute, this is not where I am in the text. Now, for me, I was highlighting, I had highlights all the way up through 120, and it seems like it went off somewhere about like at 124, where it departed. But, yeah, I thought it was, you know, maybe it's abridged, but I had been looking at the title, the cover that I have for the audiobook where it says unabridged. And I know, you know, the book I have is not edited. So, I think it skipped to later in the audiobook, because I searched and it looks like it skipped a few chapters ahead of where we should be. So what I'm going to do is just go back to the point where I think we got thrown off at and just close out, because it looks like we were just a couple pages from being at the end of chapter 3, and that'll give us definitive stop point for the audio. Okay, so I highlighted they were talking about the DPVs and how much stuff they have on it. It weighs it down. Okay, I think this is, the audio skipped somewhere about right in here, so I'll just pick up. It says, from what I understand, the DPVs were based on a design that had been used in the Baja races. Okay, yeah, I remember all that. Both my chief and I were Texans, which made that a mandatory accessory. The load added up quickly. The DPVs used a small Volkswagen engine that was, in my experience, a piece of junk. It was probably fine in a car, but maybe a dune buggy that didn't see combat. But if we took the vehicle out for 2 or 3 days, we'd almost always end up working on it for the same amount of time when we got back. Inevitably, there was some sort of bearing or bushing failing. We had to do our own maintenance. Luckily for us, my platoon included an ASCE certified mechanic, and he took charge of keeping the vehicles running. But by far the biggest drawback was the fact that they were two-wheel drive. This was a huge problem if the ground was in the least bit soft. As long as we kept going, we were usually okay, but if we stopped, we ended up in trouble. We were constantly digging them out of the sand in Kuwait. They were a blast when they worked. Being the gunner, I had the elevated seat behind the driver and navigator, who sat side by side below me, geared up with tactical ballistic goggles and helicopter-type helmet. I strapped myself in with a 5-point restraint and held on as we raced across the desert. We'd do 70 miles an hour. I let off a few bursts with the 50 caliber, then pull the lever up on the side of the seat and swivel around toward the back. There I'd grab the M60 and shoot some more. If we were simulating an attack from the side while we were moving, I could grab the M4 I was carrying and shoot in that direction. Shooting the big machine gun was fun. Aiming that sucker while the vehicle was bounding up and down across the desert was something else again. You can move the gun up and down to keep it on target, but you're never going to be particularly precise. At best, you lay down enough fire so you can get the hell out of there. Besides our 4 3-seat DPVs, we had 2 6-seaters. The 6-seaters was the plain vanilla version, 3 rows of 2 seats, with the only weapon, the 60 on the front. We used it as the command and control wagon. Very boring ride. It was the kind It was kind of like riding in a station wagon with mom when dad's got the sports car. See, we didn't need it. I think it skipped all of this. So continuing, we practiced for a few weeks. We did a lot of land navigation, built hide sites, and did SR, surveillance and reconnaissance, along the border. We dig in, cover the vehicles with netting, and try and make them disappear in the middle of the desert. Not easy for a DPV. Usually it ended up looking like a DPV trying to hide in the middle of the desert. We also practiced deploying the DPVs out of helicopters, riding out the back when they touched down on rodeo wheels. As January neared its end, we started getting worried, not that the war was going to break out, but that it would start without us. The usual SEAL deployment at the time was 6 months. We shipped out in September and were due to rotate back to the States within a few weeks. I wanted to fight. I wanted to do what I'd been trained for. American taxpayers had invested considerable dollars in my education as a SEAL. I wanted to defend my country, do my duty, and do my job. I wanted more than anything to experience the thrill of battle. Taya saw things a lot differently. Taya, I was terrified the whole time as the buildup continued toward war. Even though the war hadn't officially started, I knew they were working dangerous ops. When SEALs work, there's always some risk involved. Chris tried to play things down to me so I wouldn't worry, but I wasn't oblivious and I could read between the lines. My anxiety came out in different ways. I was jumpy. I'd see things out of the corner of my eye that weren't there. I couldn't sleep without all the lights on. I read every night until my eyes closed involuntarily. I did everything I could to avoid being alone or having too much time to think. Chris called twice with stories about helicopter accidents that he'd been in. Both were extremely minor, but he was worried that they would be reported and that I would hear about them and worry. I just want you to know, in case you hear it on the news, he'd say, the Halo was in a minor bang-up and I'm okay. One day he told me he had to go out on another helicopter exercise. The next morning I was watching the news and they reported that a helicopter had gone down near the border and everyone had died. The newscaster said it had been filled with special forces soldiers. In the military, special forces refers to Army Special Operations troops, but the newscaster had a tendency to use the term for SEALs. Immediately, I jumped to conclusions. I didn't hear from him that day, and even though he had promised to call, I told myself I'm not going to panic. It wasn't him. I poured myself into my work. That night, with still no call, I started to feel a little more anxious, then a little freaked out. I couldn't sleep, though I was exhausted from working and holding back the tears and kept threatening to overtake any sense of calm I was faking. Finally, around 1 o'clock, I was starting to crack. The phone rang. I jumped to answer it. Hey, babe, he said, as cheerful as ever. I started bawling. Chris kept asking what was wrong. I couldn't even choke out the words to explain. My fear and relief came out as unintelligible sobs. After that, I vowed to stop watching the news. That is the end of chapter 3. I don't think we heard any of that. I'm pretty certain. Like, I was just, it took me a while because I was confused trying to figure out what had happened. But yeah, I think it just skipped ahead a few chapters from where we are. But that is the close of chapter 4. And that seems like where we should be anyway. So right at the end of chapter 4, if folks would like to participate, the number is 760-569-7676. And the code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. My apologies for the confusion. I hope it didn't throw things off too much right at the end, but we should be all caught up. So you heard everything. You've heard everything through beginning of chapter 4. Again, the number 760-569-7676. The code 564-943-pound. press star 6 if you would like to participate. I'm actually trying to pretend that I didn't hear what I just heard, because I haven't read this book before, so I'm getting it for the first time with everybody else. And so some of the things that are coming, I guess, later on in chapter 8 or wherever that is, that was interesting too, but I'm trying to act like I didn't hear that. So you just focus on what we got this week up to chapter 4. If you want to use the free flash phone, it should be linked on the Black Talk Radio Network. If you can't access it there, the address you can use is tinyty.cc/oneRace. That address again, tinyty.cc/oneRace, and that is the number one. When you enter that address, look on the left side of the page. You'll see the link for the flash phone. Click that link. It will open a small window on your screen. The top line, it is a drop-down menu. Select the number I just gave out, which again is 760-569-7676. The next line, it will ask for the code. That code again is 564-943. The final line, it'll ask for a name. You can put in nickname, real name, whatever you're comfortable with. When you get all that entered, click the green button at the bottom, and it will connect you to the live broadcast. You should be able to hear us. It is the same procedure if you would like to participate. You'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press star 6. You should hear the audio prompt. Press the number 1, and we will get you on the air. My apologies again for the audio confusion. I hope it didn't throw your ability to comprehend off too much. And away we go. All the people who dialed in with a hand up, your line should be open.
Greetings. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes. I've learned out of the beginning reading, what was described, the challenge of, you know, of masculinity. I've made a comparison on how black males are portrayed, the limits of kind of like with sports, and white people call thugs. With white males, it's, you know, a lot of adventure of what I'm hearing from this white male, and primarily is a wide range of different examples, and basically under the system of race and white supremacy, there's no limit to that expression of masculinity. SEALs and units of that nature, primarily they were created after the, what I call a battle, but is commonly called World War II. Well, actually it started in World War II, for the purpose of, because they knew they were going to have wars in more quote-unquote tropical environments and against non-white people, specifically as far as historical standpoint, Japan, Korea, Vietnam, areas where people who are identified as Arab, and also, of course, Africa, in areas where non-white people reside, there's more water than that in those areas. His wife, his wife indicates that white women are conscious of their white men's need to command the front lines of terror war to maintain white supremacy. That's what I gathered when she made the speech, and I'm pretty sure she's still on the speaking tour, probably making very good money in doing so. And as a the wife of a fallen quote unquote hero, and they definitely hold up and be quite supportive of that of the white males holding up that terroristic mantra. I have also down here all of the branches, the military branches, all over the world, and actually where white people have their direct stamp on it and where they reside, they have these similar types of elite, of the quote unquote elite units. All over the world, because they're all in, you know, cahoots with one another as far as to maintain that enforcement arm, that arm of direct violence if necessary, and a lot of times actually use for those purposes. They have those units at the ready, and they stay in shape, they stay trained, and that like these special units are said to be experts in the way that non-white people fight, which they curiously call guerrilla warfare. That's a Dr. Welsing moment with that term. Basically, what is called guerrilla warfare is the way that the means or the way that non-white people wage counter war. I have here also I heard reference to urine in last week's reading. Another use of urinating was to perform it if you ran out of water because your machine gun primarily overheated, the barrel overheated, and you didn't have any water. That was also a means to cool down that barrel to be able to contain with use, because if you did not keep that barrel cool, it could possibly backfire and kill you. So with the advent of out in the on battlefield, so to speak, and sometimes you may run out of water, they would urinate on the barrel of the gun itself. That's possibly another Dr. Welsing moment also, being that the gun also, in her what I think is correct analysis, is a phallic example of white males either anguish or mental projection of male phallus. Also, last but not least, paving that is quite popular among males and a growing number of females also. It's a cycle of violence designed to subject a person to long-term slavery through physical punishment without provocation. In other words, probably the best strategy is to, if the person is not even, you know, willing to fight back or is fighting with you, to just jump on them. You know, to have that person to be in the mindset that, yeah, I'm over you, I'm in charge, and you're going to do what I tell you to do. And that's experienced in quote unquote formal war, as well as even something as trivial as indoctrination into these fraternities and sororities. Unfortunately, non-white people have adapted this behavior, i.e., if one can recall the killing of one of the drum majors at Florida A&M University. And I'll turn it over to the next caller.
The person that called in from a block number, it's a lot of background noise. I'm not sure.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'll speak later because I'm driving.
Oh, okay.
Can I be heard?
Yes.
How you doing, guys? Thomas Smith from New York.
Oh, greetings, sir. Good to hear from you.
How are you today? I was just listening to the previous caller. He made a great observation with the guerrilla warfare as the anyone who's not white. I like that. I had a few observations I like to make from listening to this. They're playing with toys. I mean, these are the most elite killers in the world, and they're riding around playing with toy Hummers and teasing Iraqis and making them run, and I could just see them just having a great old kick out of this, playing video games on the base. I mean, that's not what you would expect from elite killers and someone who killed over 100-something people. I mean, riding around with toys. The way they talk this week, when the guy's talking military, he sounded a little bit like the movie Forrest Gump when he was, you know, in the military and he was talking, and he was just the way he was sounding. The Viet Rom, I like that too. Or how they changed it because it was a fertile part of the town. They called it Viet Rom. Another observation I made is with the two guys. One was a Iraqi. He was a cook with them, and I guess he hated the fact that the Americans was there, so he was masturbating in the food. And the other one, he wanted to be an American so bad. They gave him a gun. He was like one of the guys. He couldn't shoot, but they didn't feel threatened around him at all. And it's sort of how they condition us. You know, some of us are, you know, always try to get even, and some of us are always try to be like them. They call him the legend. It kind of reminded me of Larry Bird. You know, he was the legend in basketball. I think that's his nickname. Lastly, you know, just the freedom they have. I mean, just white people in general. This guy drops out of college, joins a ranch, and, you know, he's off playing with horses and roping stuff, and then he falls off and he breaks that and he goes to another ranch. And now, you know, he's in the military. They just go from country to country and bar to bar and pull off their shirts and talk smack because they're big-time sales. And, you know, I could just I would hate to be in a bar, especially being black, with a bunch of white sales. I mean, I could just imagine. Whew. But that's all I have to say, guys. Thank you.
Just a real quick one on the Forrest Gump before the other folks can hop in. You said that it was a point where he was talking about things they were doing in the service, and it sounded like Forrest Gump. Like, did you mean just what did you mean by that?
Oh, the audio, the orator, the narrator. You know, like he sort of has that Bill Clinton smooth, you know, accent. I think the caller from Canada played that out last week. But when he got into the technical talk, you know, it sort of sounded like when Forrest Gump was describing, you know, when he was in the military, and, you know, a sergeant, he went over there, and, you know, it was just like, I was laughing while he was talking, because I'm like, man, this guy sounds like, you know, like he's a retard. He's saying I hate to say that word, but, you know, the way he was using the technical, I guess, military jargon, and you know, it just sounded like Forrest Gump. That's what I mean.
20-year anniversary of Forrest Gump was 2014. 20.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think I had mentioned that before because Pulp Fiction, Forrest Gump, and Shawshank Redemption, those are films that, I mean, getting mentioned a lot in terms of racism, white supremacy. I know Mr. Fuller mentioned Shawshank Redemption quite a bit. But although all three of those films came out in 1994, and I brought that up because I think they all got nominated for Best Film that year, and obviously.
Wow.
And
of course.
I mentioned that, and I think someone said that they were in their town, they were having a showing, like a special 20-year anniversary showing of Forrest Gump at the local theater. But I think that's extremely important. It might even be purposeful why it sounds like that.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, I didn't know that was the 20-year anniversary. Wow. Interesting.
Anybody else have comments they want to get in?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, greetings, Gus. Greetings to the other callers and listeners. My take on Mr. Chris Kyle, he's a young man that started his career in the military like many others in the United States, this particular part of the planet. And from a rural background, it would be one of the ways that he could enter into the workforce. But somewhere along the line, I think his desire to kill someone or to kill mostly non-white people warped his mind. And like a serial killer, his first kill was the hardest, but they soon get easier and easier. And I don't think that when he took part in the SEAL training and his covert operation, that the military plans for any of these people to enter back into civilian life. More or less as a race soldier or some type of law enforcement official so they can keep up their killing agenda. I also think that the psychological impact of killing large numbers of people takes its toll on the human mind. Similar to that of the Nazis when they were killing large amounts of Jewish people. Psychologists believe that that type of exposure to a large degree of killing creates a sociopath. He made reference to targets that he already had in his mind, bin Laden, Saddam Hussein. And he bought into a lot of the media hype concerning these particular countries and the leaders. It was predictable, you know, what he was saying, because we had all heard that type of media reporting about these different countries. He also, in his training, was using words like waterboarding, gassing, kicking in the balls, and hazing. And then he made reference to rules of engagement, which basically the rules of engagement was just kill any non-white person between the ages of 12 and 60, I guess. I think that hazing is really just an excuse for terrorizing someone. And he made reference to missing Christmas for the first time. And in the aftermath of killing and uncovering hidden weapons of mass destruction, he would become depressed because he couldn't spend Christmas with his white family. I thought that was quite astonishing. And then describing weaponry as being a spiritual descendant of a World War II weapon. Those were the things that stood out to me. And now I'll mute my line. Thanks for taking the call, Jeff.
Great observation. Oh, wait a minute. Let me make sure I get the other callers. I just want to... Chapter 3. I highlighted right below that. I highlighted there's a 50 caliber machine gun and an MK-19 grenade launcher on the front and an M60 on the back. Then there are LAW rockets, one-shot anti-tank weapons that are the spiritual descendants of World War II bazookas. The rockets are mounted in special brackets on the tubular upper frame. Adding to the coolness factor is the sat radio antenna on the very top of the vehicle with a donkey dick radio antenna next to it. But profound with the spiritual descendant talking about a weapon designed to kill. The other, let's see, caller at 3221, did you have comments as well?
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, listeners. This is a caller from Canada speaking.
Oh,
and I have an observation that I made that I wanted to just relay to you folks. And that was basically, I missed the first half hour, but I went in, exactly, I got on the line basically right when the SEALs were taking over another military branch's mission. I can't remember what military branch that was, but they were greeted with fuck yous, basically. Excuse my language, but that's exactly what he said. they were greeted with, they were not happy to see them because they were really upset that that these SEALs were coming to take their action, I guess, like to take their opportunity to go out and kill and use all this training. All that brainwash they've been, you know, taking the last, whatever, blah, 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 you know what I mean. Sorry. But I was thinking of that, and then I was thinking of this movie Jarhead that came out a long time ago, and I don't really remember the movie that well, but I'm sure you guys have heard of it. And but the thing that I remember the most, like when I saw it, I think I was too young even to understand it, really, what was going on. And I was kind of confused because it wasn't like a regular action film. I was expecting just an action film, which is messed up, but whatever. What I remember is at the end of the film, I think the end of the film, basically, they were all just shooting their guns into the air. Like, it was just like a bunch of people in the desert, like a bunch of American or... race soldiers or whatever. It was, never mind, sorry, it was mixed race, but, you know, like, it was Hollywood, so blah, blah, blah. Anyways, they were shooting their guns off into the air, and it was out of frustration, and I think, if I can recall, the movie was kind of talking about the frustration of like, they say the military is, like, hurry up and wait. It's like learning how to wait. I don't know if anyone... heard of anything like that, but it's like a they were describing this like all this training for like the worst case scenario and really just getting there and just kind of sitting around, you know, and maybe like just doing patrols and not really seeing any action, and this like caused a certain amount of frustration. Anyways, my point is that a lot of these people are going back home to American soil, and they maybe still have that kind of like they've gone through all this training that is like basically based on them, like they were trained to kill and they're trained to be in that action, you know, and they still feel that need to be in that action or whatever, and then they come back to American soil and they still haven't, if they're not SEALs, they still haven't seen any action. I wonder if these are the kinds of people who are making up these like militias, these are the kind of people who are coming back and who are really going to make a really hard time potentially for black people, non-white people, as far as race soldiers and the militias and carry and all that stuff. It's just an observation I had. Thanks.
The caller at 9769, you should be with us as well.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Hi. One of the things that stuck out to me in this book was when the author mentioned how SEALs are notorious for getting into bar fights and how that's one of their staples and how he's been arrested throughout the years. And how he's never had charges filed against him, or they would be dismissed. And he would ask himself, you know, why do SEALs fight so much? And he explains, you know, maybe it, you know, owed to like a lot of pent up aggression. And then I remember from earlier in the book when he broke, I think, like the pins in his arms, you know, that same, you know, kind of pent up aggression. I kind of made that connection there. And I think earlier when he was going through the training exercises and a man was, like, walking towards him and, like, the man's asking him, you know, what are you, the popo? And then, I don't know, at first, the story didn't really sound too real to me, you know, when he was mentioning it, you know, like, the popo, like, you know, who says that, you know, today, but... He says, you know, that's like a thug's term for the police, and that caught my eye when he mentioned that. So, and that's all I had to say.
Yeah, I thought that was I highlighted that as well for some of the same reasons. Number one, that sounding kind of suspect in terms of we've been talking about people should keep in mind. If there are things that are not believable about some of the anecdotes, whether or not we think this is authentic, this really happened, that had kind of a Hollywood tinge of fabrication. Like, we're just trying to make this sound and appeal to, I mean, you heard his wife, or I don't know if you did or not, but the audio that we had at the beginning was his wife, Taya Kyle, speaking to the NRA. And I think that sort of incident would appeal to that sort of white NRA audience that is definitely going to be buying a lot of these books, but white people on the whole, they would, you know, really get a good chuckle out of that story. And particularly the last 12 months, as much of this code talk that we've heard, Richard Sherman, Thug is the, I think even Charles Barkley agreed on that when he said Thug is the new millennium way of calling a black person a nigger. So I think they would definitely, it's like it's double coded. Like, I'm going to make sure we call this person a thug and make sure that we say that this person said popo, to just make sure that, you know, we're talking about black people without actually saying it. Yeah, some of the other things that I had highlighted. Let's see. Oh yeah, the non-white person, the Iraqi that was working in the kitchen and masturbating in their food, like that. That is the correct way that we should be seeing whites. Like, that makes total understandable sense. Why he would end up doing that. Like, and it reminds me, I think there's stories of black people working in the kitchen with white people and spitting in their food and that sort of thing. I mean, that's been going on for years in terms of just little daily acts of defiance against racist man, racist woman, racist child. I would just have to suspect that there was a lot of sexual misconduct going on with the Iraqis as well, just because that's the whole history of white people. The Korean War, every time, like, it's just, that's always a huge component. I think the only exception to the rule might be the Civil War, but any other time when they go out, I mean, that's a big part of, you know, the type of thing that they are doing. In fact, they had a report last year, Democracy Now, where there was all of these sex crimes that were being committed. This was in Japan, where the U.S. bases were. Underage sex crimes, pedophilia, the whole nine. Anyway, I also thought listeners should keep in mind the report that came out last year about the epidemic numbers of rapes in the armed services. They said that most of the victims were males. I thought that was important, too, to keep in mind while we're reading this. Some of the other things that I had highlighted, let's see. This just seems very, very homoerotic. Like, everything about this book just reeks of a real pervading sense of homosexuality and just the homoeroticism. It's the gun talk and everything, where he was talking last week, he was talking about lusting for the gun that his brother had when they were growing up. I mean, that penis envy is basically what that is. This is from page 100. For me, it's 100. They got me pretty wasted before we even got to the felonies. At some point, they stripped me down and put ice down my drawers. Finally, I passed out.
7-0.
I'm sorry. Were you saying something to us? Oh, okay. Yeah, they spray painted me and for good measure drew Playboy bunnies on my chest and back with a marker. Just the sort of body art you want for your honeymoon. This just is, I mean, that just seems extremely like hyper gay in my opinion. Every aspect of it. I don't know people on here. I mean, that does not sound fun and exciting to me to go and put ice on another man's crotch like that, you know. I am not interested in that. Like, it's just all of it, like the paint and welsing moment, spray painting somebody, and I mean, just all of this just is super, super gay. Let's see.
Yes.
Yes, sir.
Yes, excuse me for interrupting. I just didn't want you to go to another subject before I chime in on what you're talking about. Even from a historical standpoint, I can go back as far as the SA, which is the precursor to the SS. And they were highly, homosexual or anti-sexual, to where it even disturbed Adolf Hitler. the head of the SA, who was a close friend of Adolf Hitler, who ended up killing him, you know, figure that, you know, you kill one of your best friends. But nevertheless, that a lot of these so-called elite units where the males spend very, very long times, long periods of times around each other on a year basis with all this training and whatnot, a lot of those type of things go on. Mixed with hazing, or what they call just having the boys just having fun, and it goes from that silly touchy stuff to out and out sexual activity. It is something that's pretty much normal when it comes to in my opinion when it comes to those types of settings. It happens also in athletics. I can say that also, you know, from that standpoint. That's why the black male that played at Missouri, what's his name?
Sam.
Michael Sams. I think it was just reported that he understands that, you know, that he's alluding to that he's met more homosexuals. While his short period of time in the National Football League, while he was there, you know, so that's just a little bit of history from my understanding about the whole subject. You know, they spend great long periods of time around each other, you know, through under the umbrella of training, because in order to get that good at killing, and being able to adjust around the world at killing people in the most in preciseness, you have to have a lot of training. You have to have a lot of training, and guys are getting real physical and getting physical with each other, and it goes to quote unquote horseplay, as they call it, you know, and all kinds of different things start happening, you know, and there's a long history behind it when it comes to white people, especially. Move it on.
Absolutely. I also, because there's so many of these references to kicking someone in the balls, or just it's very genital focused, either literally or symbolically. The golden showers last week is super gay. They also this portion of the instructors tortured us hard as they could, tying us up and pounding on us. Just homoeroticism is everywhere. Just short of permanently damaging us. They say each of us has a breaking point and that prisoners eventually give in, but I would have done my best to make them kill me before I gave up secrets. That torturing thing, it's normalized. I even find it interesting that here it's no problem. Like that, I suspect, that does not have white readers in a tizzy, him saying that they tortured us, even with the current climate that's been focused, you know, the Senate's report on torture fast, but it's just normalized under the system of white supremacy, which is torture of non-white people. Torture just becomes normalized. It even becomes something proud. I think it's a very sadomasochistic bent to a lot of this as well. I mean, he keeps talking about that. He says training was fun. Even when it kicked us in the balls, like that right there, it's a very sadomasochistic presentation of violence and homoerotic violence. And even matter of fact, I was thinking he gives that anecdote about them putting ice down his drawers on his crotch as his part of his, I guess, their bachelor celebration. You get a more intimate picture of him and these other white guys than you do anything related to his honeymoon. Like all you get with that is just, she was upset because it was 3 days and she let him know about it. Moving on, but you get this real erotic depiction of what he did with the fellas, you know, before his marriage. Some of the other things that stood out, it was a fierce competition, and not just out on the training range. The officers were backstabbing each other. They'd go to the CO and dime each other out. White people do fight with other white people on a regular basis. Thought that was, that they're, you know, if they're doing this to one another, then you know what they would be willing to do to a black person. Lavina Johnson. Also thought it was significant when he talked about their competition for missions, and they ended up coming out second. And so they didn't get to go and kill and fight. And how disappointed almost it was the same. It was the same way when they took the mission from the other group and they were upset with them and cursing at them, like they were jealous, like they had lost a lover or a potential sexual mate, and they're upset about it. Like this new guy, I mean, it's just a lot of homoerotic violence in this book throughout. That's a huge theme thus far. Let's see, anything else? I want to make sure I get the other caller. The scene about the bar as well. I mean, that right there, I thought that scene. Normally you go to bars to pick up girls. He's bragging about going to bars and beating up people. Like, I didn't get any sense at all of, you know, hey, we went there and the girls lined up and it was a new face and every time. I didn't get that at all. It was, man, we went, we beat people, knocked people out. Went to jail. It was great. We had a blast. Like that's the sense that I got from it. Let's see. Anything else stood out? The Christmas. Yeah, I thought that was important as well. Got that. I think it's significant they have his wife pulled in the book, but I'll comment on that later. The person that dialed in. From a block number, did you have anything you wanted to add or anybody else before we get to the second audio segment? You should get your hand up now as opposed to lollygagging. Block number, did you have comments you wanted to get in?
Yes, it's Karma. Thank you guys for being so patient. Good evening. I don't know. I'm looking at the things that I think are misleading. Now that I'm thinking about it, white people are pretty intolerant of heat. I mean, that's just the decreased amount of sweat glands and all that other stuff that they have. And he hasn't mentioned that not even once. I find that very strange. They are very intolerant of heat. They're intolerant of the heat here in Texas. And I said, so I think what's happening is every weakness is being eliminated from this book. And I said the same thing about the cold in Colorado. He made such a big deal about the cold in Colorado. But, you know, I've been to Colorado. It's cold, but it's... but I don't think that that's enough to... white people are there. I mean, they love Colorado. It's just great. So, I think he's being deliberately misleading about some things. And a second thing, the weaknesses. I think he's being deliberately misleading about the weaknesses. And the thing about, if I'm not mistaken, I believe it was Germany's stupidity about not adapting the vehicles for the climate that they were going to be used in and just having to go through them, you know, like every time they got, you know, Russian sand or something, and then they just had to throw them away. And, you know, he's talking about this, what do they call them, the desert, the DPVs? It's like the same thing. They don't seem really good with equipment. For technological, you know, saying they're so technologically superior, I find that very strange. I find it strange that they're out there with vehicles that haven't been adapted to that environment. They get sand in the ball bearings, and I'm like, da-da, this isn't... you know, a two-wheel vehicle? I mean, how smart is that? So that's kind of strange, too, and I've been thinking about that. And then the other section where, you know, they painted his body and beat him up and everything before his honeymoon, I said, you know, they were just marking their territory. That's what dogs do. You know, okay, we won't pee on them, but, we'll paint them all up and we'll put a couple of bruises on them, and then we'll hand them over to the woman, and when she sees him, she'll know that this is us. It has our markings on it. And that just had all the markings of territoriality to me. And then I love this paragraph. He says, with the conflict in Iraq on the horizon, our emphasis shifted, blah, blah, blah. We work hard, but there were always lighter moments. So that's how he described beating up an unarmed American civilian. Those were lighter moments. Those were lighter moments. You know, and he describes in detail how he kicked this guy's ass. In detail. You know, I thought about this, and then I pummeled him this way. I thought about that, and then I did this. And instead of the people who were supposed to be there to protect themselves, they're just laughing and laughing. There's just no protection going on. There's no serving going on. All of it was having just a wonderful party. It's just awesome. See what else was it that I was looking at real quick. How? Oh, yeah, that competition thing. You know, the greatest military machine. It's like all of the parts work together as a giant machine. You know, I never got to go to the military. I was forbidden. But this competition thing where the only people you just hate everybody. I mean, you just hate every other person in the military. You're in competition with every other unit, no matter how small. Your whole world, and I guess they say this often enough, is just those guys in your unit, and that's your whole world. You just want to protect those few guys in your unit. You're not concerned about the military or the war or the reason they're doing anything is just protecting those few guys in your unit. That's your whole planet. And everyone else in the military is your enemy. They are your enemy also. So, I mean, I said that's very strong. I mean, these people are just dangerous. I wonder how many there are. And the second one is the very last thing, is in my book, they took out the name of the Korean military ship. They said the Korean freighter, the North Korean freighter. And in the when it was being read, it kept calling it the Sosan, the Sosan. But in the book, it just goes, the ship, the ship, the ship, the ship. It doesn't say the name of the vessel. And I said, I wonder what that means. And those are the only observations I had. But I like that protected surf thing. That was good.
The what thing? Protect, what did you say?
The fact that the police are sitting there. They have nothing to say. They're just rippling. They're rolling. This is fun.
Mm-hmm. And you see how they justify it? He's a thug. And he's a drug dealer. And he's stupid. Yeah. So it's like... this is a black person, so I mean, of course, this is justified, you know. And again, the same thing. You have people, whites, that are jealous. You know, we wish we could have beaten this black person the way you just. I mean, that's. Anywho, I thought Karma would get a kick out of this book. The studying white people. A person wrote in, they said, a couple of observations. Chris's mental status is exactly what Dr. Frances Cress-Welsing describes in her book, The Narcissistic, Anxiety, and Psychopathic. His developmental level is based on fantasy, TV tropes, and the notion of being a warrior. How violence and sex culture among these males, 8th and 9th area of activity, absolutely. Them on the water taking over other oil tanker ships was like being pirates. And then the dehumanization in his mind of other humans not capable of feeling. I have more and wonder how many soldiers are now in domestic enforcement. Listener wrote that in. Unless folks have things that they wanted to get in before we get to the next. Well, it won't be an audio segment today because I think the audio is off. So if other people have the book, we could even do a little reading session. That would be a cute way to start the year. People had asked about that before. People that have the book would like to take turns reading. That would be grand, and then I wouldn't have to read the whole thing, which is great. Maybe we can get through all of Chapter 4. I would consider that a victory. Anybody have anything else they wanted to get in before we get to Chapter 4?
Yeah, I had a quick one, Gus. As I wrote you before several times, man, I'm playing football. This sounds a lot like football camp, you know, and especially with the sexual eroticism that you guys are discussing. I believe one of the guys on the line, I believe he mentioned before that he's a football coach. And I went to a primarily diverse school, and I mean, like, the stuff the white boys would do and talk about, you know, would just kill me. And it was funny, the guy who called in earlier from Canada, he mentioned the movie. I forgot the name of it, but I saw that movie, and I remembered they were in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they were pretty much acting like these guys because there was no war then. This was the first Gulf War. And they sat back and talked about, you know, which hand was better to masturbate with, the left or right, and they'll go in a room and practice it, and it was just crazy. It was like, the way they talk sexually is very, very, you know, everything is very eroticized, you know, squeezing each other's butts and feeling each other, and the weaker one is treated like a female, and they pinch their nipples and all kinds of crazy stuff they would do. So, yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm. I want to get started unless somebody has something quick that they can. I thought the hazing was super important as well, particularly as was mentioned about Florida A&M University and the job that they did on them. But I mean, this is standard from what I've seen in terms of how white male bonding, particularly. Something you can get in like 30 seconds, if anything.
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I just wanted to mention the speech that his wife was giving at the beginning, you know, it sounded hypocritical based upon the way she felt while he was actually in the service and in another country and with the SEAL team. She felt jealous because he was becoming closer to his SEAL team In other words, his SEAL team became his first love, and she felt like that he didn't, you know, feel the same way about her as he did at first after he became a SEAL. But yet and still, when she was doing this speech with the NRA, she didn't mention any of that. So I just thought that that hypocritical point should be brought up. I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that. Appreciate that. All righty. Again, it would be wonderful, any of the folks, if you actually have the book and would like to pitch in, we can take turns reading Chapter 4. That would be lovely. I will get us started, I guess. And I will say that, you know, this is one of those, because I had we have listeners now who volunteered to do some reading for us, which is grand, because I prefer not to read it. A book like this, where you have the white narrator, I think it's great just to be able to hear, like, a caller in New York who's pointing out that he felt it sounded like Forrest Gump at times, and just I think that is critical to just another layer of understanding and what that reveals about the white psychology. But we will make do, and hopefully the audio will be all taken care of for next week. So I'm picking up, we're starting Chapter 4, 5 Minutes to Live, 5 Minutes to Live. I'll read, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 pages, and then if somebody wants to take over and read a little bit, they can switch from there. So this is Chapter 4. For me, it's 128, Dune Buggies and Mud Don't Mix. Geared up and strapped in, I sat vibrating in the gunner's chair of the DPV shortly after nightfall, March 20th, 2003, as an Air Force MH-53 lifted off the runway in Kuwait. The vehicle had been loaded into the rear of the PAVE low aircraft, and we were en route toward the missions we'd spent the past several weeks rehearsing. The waiting was... I'm gonna... just mute some of the lines, and then I'll open them once I'm checking for readers. We'd spent the past several weeks rehearsing. The waiting was about to come to an end. Operation Iraqi Freedom was underway. My war was finally here. I was sweating, and not just with excitement, not knowing exactly what Saddam might have in store. We'd been ordered to wear full MOPP gear, mission-oriented protective posture, or spacesuits to some. The suits protect chemical against chemical attacks, but they're about as comfortable as rubber pajamas, and the gas mask that comes with them is twice as bad. Feet wet, said someone over the radio. I checked my guns. They were ready, including the 50. All I had to do was pull back the charging handle and load. We were pointed straight toward the back of the helicopter. The rear ramp was not all the way up, so I could see out into the night. Suddenly, the black strip I was watching above the ramp speckled with red. The Iraqis had kicked on anti-aircraft radars and weapons that intel had claimed didn't exist, and the chopper pilots began shooting off decoy flares and chaff to confuse them. Then came the tracers, streams of bullets arcing across the narrow rectangle of black. Damn, I thought, we're going to get shot down before I even get a chance to smoke someone. Somehow the Iraqis managed to miss us. The helicopter kept moving, swooping toward land. Feet dry, said someone over the radio. We were now over land. All hell was breaking loose. We were part of a team tasked to hit Iraqi oil resources before the Iraqis could blow them up or set them on fire as they had during Desert Storm in 1991. SEALs and GROM were hitting gas and oil platforms, geoplats, in the Gulf as well as onshore oil refinery and port areas. 12 of us were tasked to hit farther inland at the Al-Faw oil refinery. The few extra minutes it took translated into a hell of a lot of gunfire, and by the time the helicopter touched down, we were in the shit. The ramp dropped, and our driver hit the gas. I locked and loaded, ready to fire as we sped down the ramp. The DPV careened onto the soft dirt and promptly got stuck. Son of a bitch. The driver started revving the engine and slapping the transmission back and forth, trying to budge us free. At least we were out of the helicopter. One of the other DPVs got stuck half on and half off the ramp. His 53 jerked up and down, trying desperately to free him. Pilots hate like hell to get fired at, and they wanted out. By this time, I could hear the different DPV units checking in over the radio. Just about everybody was stuck in the oil-soaked mud. The intel specialist advising us had claimed that the ground would be hard-packed where we were going to land. Of course, she and her colleagues had also claimed the Iraqis didn't have anti-aircraft weapons. Like they say, military intelligence is an oxymoron. "We're stuck," said our chief. "Yeah, we're stuck too," said the lieutenant. "We're stuck," said somebody else. "Fuck, we gotta get out of here." "All right, everybody get out of your vehicles and go to your positions," said the chief. I undid the five-point harness, grabbed the 60 off the back, and humped in the direction of the fence that blocked off the oil facility. Our job was to secure the gate, and just because we didn't have wheels to do it with didn't mean it wasn't getting done. I found a pile of rubble in sight of the gate and set up the 60. A guy came up next to me with a Carl Gustav, technically a recoilless rifle. The weapon fires a badass rocket that can take out a tank or poke a hole in a building. Nothing was getting through the gate without our say-so. The Iraqis had set up a defensive perimeter outside the refinery. Their only problem was that we had landed inside. We were now between them and the refinery. In other words, behind their positions. They didn't like that all that much. They turned around and started firing at us. As soon as I realized that we weren't getting gassed, I threw off my gas mask. Returning fire with the 60, I had plenty of targets, too many, in fact. We were heavily outnumbered, but that was not a real problem. We began calling in air support. Within minutes, all sorts of aircraft were overhead. FA-18s, F-16s, A-10As, even an AC-130 gunship. The Air Force A-10s, better known as Warthogs, were awesome. They're slow-moving jets, but that's intentional. They're designed to fly low and slow so they can put a maximum amount of gunfire on ground targets. Besides bombs and missiles, they're equipped with a 30mm Gatling gun, Gatling cannon. Those Gatlings chewed the hell out of the enemy that night. The Iraqis rolled armor out of the city to get us, but they never got close. It got to the point where the Iraqis realized they were fucked and tried to flee. Big mistake. That just made them easier to see. The planes kept coming, nailing them. They had them zeroed in and zeroed them out. You'd hear the rounds coming past you in the air. Rrr. Then you'd hear the echo. Rrr. Followed closely by secondary explosions and whatever other havoc the bullets caused. Fuck, I thought to myself, this is great. I fucking love this. It's nerve-wracking and exciting, and I fucking love it. We would be at Gast if someone wants to read for a few pages. Any takers to read?
I'll take Gast.
Great. Have at it.
Gast. A British unit flew in the morning. By then, the battle was over. Of course, we couldn't resist needling them about it. "Come on in. The fighting's over," we said. "It's safe for you." I don't think they thought it was funny, but it was hard to tell. They speak English funny. Exhausted, we moved back inside the gate to a house that had been almost completely destroyed during the firefight. We went into the ruins, dropped down between the rubble, and fell asleep. A few hours later, I got up. Most of the other guys in my company were stirring as well. We went outside and started checking the perimeter of the oil fields. While we were out, we spotted some of the air defenses the Iraqis didn't have. But the intel reports didn't have to be updated. Those defenses were now in no shape to bother anyone. There were dead bodies everywhere. We saw one guy who literally had his ass blown off. He bled to death, but not before he tried to drag himself away from the planes. You could see the blood trail in the dirt. While we were sorting things out, I spotted a Toyota pickup in the distance. It drove up on the road and stopped a little more than a mile away. White civilian pickup trucks were used by the Iraqis as military vehicles throughout the war. Usually they were some version of the Toyota Helix, the compact pickup built in a variety of styles. In the States, the Helix was often called the SR-5. The model was eventually discontinued here, though it continued to be sold overseas. Not sure what was going on, we stared at the truck for a few moments until we heard a whoop. Something went splat a few yards from us. The Iraqis had fired a mortar round from the rear bed. It sank harmlessly into the oily mud. Thank God that thing didn't blow up, somebody said. We'd be dead. White smoke started pouring out of the hole where the projectile had landed. Gas, someone yelled. We started running as fast as we could back to the gate, but just before we reached it, the British guards slammed it shut and refused to open up. You can't come in, one of them yelled. You've just been gassed. While Marine Cobras flew in overhead to take care of the mortar trucks, we tried to figure out if we were going to die. When we were still breathing a few minutes later, we realized the smoke had been just that, smoke. Maybe it was the steam from the mud, whatever. It was all sizzle, no boom, no gas, which was a relief. I'm done.
Right on. Any other folks want to chip in to read a tad if you have the book? We're at Shat al-Arab, if anybody wants to read. Okie doke, I will read myself. Get the audio correct next time. So, Shat al-Arab. With Al-Fall secured, we rigged up two of our DPVs and hit the road, driving north to Shat al-Arab, the river that separates Iran and Iraq. As it flows out to the Gulf, our job was to look for suicide boats and mine layers that might be coming down the river to the Gulf. We found an old border station abandoned by the Iraqis and set up an observation post. Our ROEs, when the war kicked off, were pretty simple. If you see anyone from about 16 to 65 and they're male, shoot them. Kill every male you see. That wasn't official language, but that was the idea. Now that we were watching Iran, however, we were under strict orders not to fire, at least not at Iran. Every night, someone on the other side of the river would stand up and take a shot at us. We would dutifully call it in and ask for permission to return fire. The answer was always a very distinct no, very loud and clear. Looking back, this made a lot of sense. Our heaviest weapons were a Carl Gustav and 260s. The Iranians had plenty of artillery, and they had the position dialed in. It wouldn't have taken anything for them to hit us, and in fact, what they were probably trying to do was suck us into a fight so they could kill us. It did piss us off, though. Somebody shoots at you, you want to shoot back. After the high of the start of the war, our spirits sagged. We were just sitting around doing nothing. One of the guys had a video camera, and we made a video poking fun at it. There wasn't much else to do. We found a few Iraqi weapons and gathered them in a pile to be blown up. But that was it. The Iraqis weren't sending boats our way, and the Iranians would only fire a single shot, then duck and wait for us to react. About the most entertaining thing we could do was to wade in the water and piss in their direction. For a week, we took turns on watch, two guys on, four guys off. Monitored the radio and watched the water. Finally, we were relieved by another set of SEALs and headed back to Kuwait. The race to Baghdad. By now, the so-called race to Baghdad had begun. American and Allied units were streaming across the border, making large advances every day. We spent a few days hanging around our camp back in Kuwait, waiting for an assignment. As frustrating as our stay at the border station was, this was worse. We wanted to be in action. There were any number of missions we could have accomplished, eliminating some of those non-existent air defenses farther into Iraq, for example, but the command didn't seem to want to use us. Our deployment had been extended so that we could take part in the beginning of the war, but now the rumor was that we would be rotated back to the States and replaced by Team 5. No one wanted to leave Iraq now that the action was getting hot. Morale hit rock bottom. We were all pissed off. To top things off, the Iraqis had sent some scuds over just before the war started. Most had been taken care of by Patriot missiles, but one got through. Wouldn't you know it, took out the Starbucks where we'd hung out during our pre-war training. That's low, hitting a coffee place. It could have been worse, I guess. It could have been a Dunkin' Donuts. The joke was that President Bush only declared war when the Starbucks was hit. You can mess with the UN all you want, but when you start interfering with the right to get caffeinated, someone has to pay. We stayed for 3 or 4 days, grousing and depressed the whole time. Then finally, we joined the Marine push in the area of Nazaria. We were back in the war, near Nazaria. Nazaria is a city on the Euphrates River in the southern Iraq, about 125 miles northwest of Kuwait. The city itself was taken by the Marines on March 31st, but action in the area, continued for quite some time as small groups of Iraqi soldiers and Fedayeen continued to resist and attack Americans. It was near Nazaria that Jessica Lynch was captured and held during the first few days of the war. Some historians believe that the fighting in the area was the fiercest the Marines encountered during the war, comparing it with the most ferocious firefights in Vietnam and later in Fallujah. Besides the city itself, the Marines took Jaliba Airfield, several bridges over the Euphrates and highways and towns that secured the passage to Baghdad during the early stages of the war. Along the way, they began encountering the sort of fanatical insurgency that would characterize the war after Baghdad fell. We had an extremely small part in the conflict there. We got into some very intense battles, but the bulk of the action was by Marines. Obviously, I can't write about most of that. What I saw of the overall battle was like looking at an enormous landscape painting through a tiny straw. When you're working with Army and Marine Corps units, you immediately notice a difference. The Army is pretty tough, but their performance can depend on the individual unit. Some are excellent, filled with hoorah and first-class warriors. A few are absolutely horrible. Most are somewhere in between. In my experience, Marines are gung-ho no matter what. They will all fight to the death. Every one of them just wants to get out there and kill. They are badass, hard-charging mothers. We inserted into the desert in the middle of the night with 2 3-seat DPVs driving off the back of a 53. The ground was firm enough that no one got stuck. We were behind the tip of the U.S. advance, and there were no enemy units in the area. We drove up through the desert until we came to an Army base camp. We rested a few hours with them, then took off to scout for the Marines ahead of their advance. The desert wasn't entirely empty. While there were long stretches of wilderness, there were also towns and very small settlements strung out in the distance. We mostly skirted the towns, observing them from a distance. Our job was to get an idea of where the enemy's strong points were, radioing them back so the Marines could decide whether to attack or bypass them. Every so often, we'd reach high ground, stop for a while, and take a scan. We had only one significant contact that day. We were skirting by a city. We obviously got too close because they started engaging us. I fired the 50 cal, then swung around to the 60 as we hauled ass out of there. We must have traveled hundreds of miles that day. We lay up for a while in the late afternoon, got some rest, and took off again after nightfall. When we started attracting fire that night, our orders were changed. The head shed called us back and arranged for the helicopters to come back and pick us up. You might think that our job was to attract fire since that revealed where the enemy was. You might think that the fact that we were close enough to get the enemy to fire meant we had discovered a significant force that was previously unknown. You might think that meant we were doing well. You might be right, but to our CO, it was all wrong. He wanted us not to get contacted. He didn't want to risk any casualties, even if that meant we couldn't do our mission properly. And I should add that despite the gunfire and the earlier contact, we had not taken any casualties. We were pissed. We went out expecting to be scouting for a week. We had plenty of fuel, water, and food, and had already figured out how to get resupplied if we needed to. Hell, we could have gone all the way to Baghdad, which at the moment was still in Iraqi hands. We reported back to base dejected. That wasn't the end of the war for us, but it was a bad sign of what lay ahead. You have to understand, no SEAL wants to die. The purpose of war, as Patton put it, is to make the other dumb bastard die. But we also want to fight. Part of it is personal. It's the same way for the athlete. An athlete wants to be in a big game, wants to compete on the field or in the ring. But another part, a bigger part, I think, is patriotism. It's the sort of thing that if it has to be explained, you're not going to understand. But maybe this will help. One night later on, we were in an exhausting firefight. 10 of us spent roughly 48 hours in the second story of an old abandoned brick building, fighting in 100-degree plus heat, wearing full armor. Bullets flew in, demolishing the walls around us practically nonstop. The only break we took was to reload. Finally, as the sun came up in the morning, the sound of gunfire and bullets hitting brick stopped. The fight was over. It became eerily quiet. When the Marines came in to relieve us, they found every man in the room either slumped against a wall or collapsed on the floor, dressing wounds or just soaking in the situation. One of the Marines outside took an American flag and hoisted it over the position. Someone else played the national anthem. I have no idea where the music came from, but the symbolism and the way it spoke to the soul was overwhelming. It remains one of my most powerful memories. Every battle-weary man rose, went to the window, and saluted. The words of the music echoed in each of us as we watched the stars and stripes wave literally in dawn's early light. The reminder of what we were fighting for caused tears as well as blood and sweat to run freely from all of us. I lived in the literal meaning of the land of the free and home of the brave. It's not corny for me. I feel it in my heart. I feel it in my chest. Even at a ball game, when someone talks during the anthem or doesn't take off his hat, it pisses me off. I'm not one to be quiet about it either. For myself and the SEALs I was with, patriotism and getting into the heat of the battle were deeply connected, but how much a unit like ours can fight depends a lot on leadership. Much of it is up to the head shed and the officers who lead us. SEAL officers are a real mix. Some are good, some are bad, and some are just pussies. Oh, they may be tough individuals, but it takes more than personal toughness to be good leaders. The methods and goals have to contribute to the toughness. Our top command wanted us to achieve 100% success and do it with zero casualties. That may sound admirable. Who doesn't want to succeed and who wants anyone to get hurt? But in war, those are incompatible and unrealistic. If 100% success, zero casualties are your goal, you're going to conduct very few operations. You will never take any risks, realistic or otherwise. Ideally, we could have done sniper overwatches and undertaken scouting missions for the Marines all around Nigeria. We could have been a much bigger part of the Marines' drive. We might have saved some of their lives. We wanted to go out at night and hit the next big city or town the Marine Corps was going to pass through. We'd soften the target for them, killing off as many bad guys as we could. We did do a few missions like that, but it was certainly a lot less than we could have done. We have 8 pages left in the chapter. Anyone want to take a few pages?
Hello?
Yes.
Sure, I'm Aubrey.
Groovy. We're at Evil. For me, it's 147.
Okay. Evil, I had never known that much about Islam. Raised as a Christian, obviously, I knew there had been religious conflicts for centuries. I knew about the Crusades, and I knew that there had been fighting and atrocities forever. But I also knew that Christianity had evolved from the Middle Ages. We don't kill people because they're a different religion. The people we were fighting in Iraq after Saddam's army fled or was defeated were fanatics. They hated us because we weren't Muslims. They wanted to kill us, even though we just booted out their dictator because we practiced a different religion than they did. Isn't religion supposed to teach tolerance? People say you have to distance yourself from your enemy to kill him. If that's true, in Iraq, the insurgents made it really easy. The fanatics we fought valued nothing but their twisted interpretation of religion. And half the time, they just claimed they valued their religion. Most didn't even pray. Quite a number were drugged up so they couldn't fight us. Many of the insurgents were cowards. They routinely used drugs to stoke their courage. Without them alone, they were nothing. I have a tape somewhere showing a father and a girl in the house that was being searched. They were downstairs for some reason. A flashbang went off upstairs. On the video, the father hides behind the girl, afraid that he's going to be killed and ready to sacrifice his daughter. Hidden bodies. They may have been cowards, but they could certainly kill people. The insurgents didn't worry about ROEs or court martials. If they had the advantage, they would kill any Westerner they could find, whether they were soldiers or not. One day we were sent to a house where we had heard there might be U.S. prisoners. We didn't find anyone in the building, but in the basement there were obvious signs that the dirt had been disturbed, so we set up lights and started digging. It wasn't long before I saw a pants leg, then a body, freshly buried. An American soldier, Army. Next to him was another, then another man, this one wearing Marine camis. My brother had joined the Marines a little before 9/11. I hadn't heard from him, and I thought that he had deployed to Iraq. For some reason, as I pulled the dead body up, I was sure it was my brother. It wasn't. I said a silent prayer, and we kept digging. Another body, another Marine. I bent over and forced myself to look. Not him. But now, with each man we pulled out of that grave, and there were a bunch, I was more and more convinced I was going to see my brother. My stomach tightened. I kept digging. I wanted to puke. Finally, we were done. He wasn't there. I felt a moment of relief, even elation. None of them were my brother. Then I felt tremendous sadness for the murdered young men whose bodies we had pulled out. When I finally heard from my brother, I found out that even though he was in Iraq, he hadn't been anywhere near where I'd seen those bodies. He'd had his own scares and hard times, I'm sure, but hearing his voice just made me feel a lot better. I was still a big brother hoping to protect him. Hell, he didn't need me to watch over him. He was a Marine and a tough one. But somehow, those old instincts never go away. At another location, we found barrels of chemical material that was intended for use as biochemical weapons. Everyone talks about there being no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, but they seem to be referring to completed nuclear bombs, not the many deadly chemical weapons or precursors that Saddam had stockpiled. Maybe the reason is that the writing on the barrels showed that the chemicals came from France and Germany, our supposed Western allies. The thing I always wonder about is how Saddam was able to hide before we actually invaded. We'd given so much warning before we came in that he surely had time to move and bury tons of material. Where it went, where it will turn up, what it will poison, I think those are pretty good questions that have never been answered. One day, we saw some things in the desert and thought they were buried IEDs. We called the bomb disposal people, and they came out. Lo and behold, what they found wasn't a bomb, it was an airplane. Saddam had buried a bunch of his fighters in the desert. He had them covered with plastic and tried to hide them. Probably he figured we'd come through like we did in Desert Storm, hit quick, and then leave. he was wrong about that. We're going to die. We continued working with the Marines as they marched north. Our missions would typically take us out ahead of their advance, scouting for knots of defenders. Although we had intel that there were some enemy soldiers in the area, there weren't supposed to be any large units. By this time, we were working with the entire platoon, all 16 of us. We came up to a small building compound at the edge of a town. Once we were there, we began taking fire. The firefight quickly ratcheted up, and within a few minutes, we realized we were surrounded, our escape cut off by a force of several hundred Iraqis. I started killing a lot of Iraqis. We all were. But for everyone we shot, four or five seemed to materialize to take their place. This went on for hours, with the fighting stoking up, then dying down. Most firefights in Iraq were sporadic. It might be very intense for a few minutes, but perhaps even an hour or more. But eventually the Iraqis would withdraw, or we would. That didn't happen here. The fight continued in waves all through the night. The Iraqis knew they had us outnumbered and surrounded, and they weren't quitting. Little by little, they started getting closer and closer, until it became obvious that they were going to overrun us. We were done. We were going to die. Or worse, we'd be captured and made prisoners. I thought about my family and how horrible that would all be. I determined I was dying first. I fired off more of my rounds, but now the fight was getting closer. I was starting to think about what I would do if they charged us. I'd use my pistol, my knife, my hands, anything. And then I would die. I thought of Taya and how much I loved her. I tried not to get distracted by anything, tried concentrating on the fight. The Iraqis kept coming. We estimated we had 5 minutes to live. I started counting it off in my head. I hadn't gotten very far when a company radio squeaked with the transmission. We're coming up on your six. Friendlies were approaching our position. The cavalry, the Marines, actually. We weren't going to die. Not in 5 minutes, anyway. Thank God. Out of the fight. That action turned out to be our last significant encounter during that deployment. The CEO pulled us back to base. It was a waste. The Marines were going to Nasiriyah every night, trying to clear the place out as the insurgency stoked up. They could have given us our own section that we could patrol. We could have rolled in and taken out the bad guys, but the CO vetoed it. We heard it at the forward bases and camps where we were sitting around and waiting for something real to do. The Grom, the Polish Special Forces, were going out and doing jobs. They told us we were lions led by dogs. The Marines were blunter. They'd come back every night and bust on us. How many of y'all did y'all get tonight? Oh, that's right. Y'all didn't go out. Ball busters. But I couldn't blame them. I thought our head shed was a bunch of pussies. We had started training to take down Makarian Dam northeast of Baghdad. The dam was important not only because it provided hydroelectric power, but because if it were allowed to flood, it could have slowed military forces attacking Iraqis in the area. But the mission was continually postponed and finally given to SEAL Team 5 when they rotated into the Gulf toward the end of our stay. The mission, which followed our basic plan, was a success. There are many things we could have done. How much of an impact on the war they would have had, I have no idea. We certainly could have saved a few lives here and there, maybe shorten some conflicts by a day or more. Instead, we were told to get ready to go home. Our deployment was over. I sat back at base for a couple of weeks with nothing to do. I felt like a little fucking coward playing video games and waiting to ship out. I was pretty pissed. In fact, I was so mad I wanted to leave the Navy and give up being a SEAL.
Context of White Supremacy. Thank you to everyone for chipping in and reading. Make the best of the situation. We still got where I wanted to go in the book. We should be picking up on Chapter 5 next Friday, Sniper. Chapter 5 for next week. Again, thank you to the folks who helped out with the reading. I was glad I didn't have to read the whole thing. For folks who would like to chime in, the number to dial is 760-569-7669. 7676, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. I hate it when I'll be reading passages that I would highlight, but it's a little more difficult if you're reading aloud. But yeah, I still managed to get my highlighter active. Everyone who dialed in with a hand up, your line should be open if you had thoughts, things you wanted to contribute. Quite a few hands. Did nobody had any comments, any observations?
For the most part, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I want to make sure. For the most part, my thoughts are on overall his glee of being in combat, his aggressiveness. Is a badge of white male masculinity that I have experienced through white males in sports, as well as on a job, the whole aspect of bragging about. How crazy or quote unquote brave one is, it's you know transferred and challenged. Yeah, well, I can do it better than you. Is prevalent in the book. This individual, he is atypical. I've been experiencing it through most of my life. And my contact with white males has primarily been through sports and or in the fire service, which is a close in alliance with domestic enforcement. And a lot of the employees of both of those jobs were just like him in a military uniform prior to obtaining one or both of those jobs. Another observation from just listening to the readings is in the necessity on the maintenance of the system of racism and white supremacy. Just to show you the tremendous amount of violent advantage that they have been asserting over the for the most part of the 20th century, and in the new 21st century, for the most part, when they waged war against non-white people, they were waging war against them right in the area where those non-white people stay at. I would say some of the most difficult situations they were in were like against the non-white people that are called Japanese, because at that time the waterways is close in proximity to this person because he was in the Navy. The waterways were vast, and the race soldiers were not in total control of the waterways at the time, so they had to go about the means of securing that, which they eventually got to the point to whereas, we would stand, if we land in Japan itself, we would stand the issue of having to lose more life, so they just dropped those terrible atomic bombs on those non-white people. Moving up to present day times, I think what they get the most out of the killing that they do now is practice. It's practice and you know, continue live drills and whatnot as far as that concerns, so they can also insert some of those tactics and strategies right here where we're speaking from. Those individuals join domestic enforcement, and they become the teachers. They become the teachers of the different law enforcement in this part of the world. The same behavior, same attitude as how they view the enemy is transferable. It goes from quote-unquote Arab to quote-unquote African-American black people. I notice a lot of the same jargon, the language, with the abbreviations of everything. I've heard all of that through that 27 and a half years on that job. You know, the same thing, and they pride themselves in it. It's like a prideful thing to do. Even when they're talking socially, they use the language. They use that language. It's all a part of the, I guess you, the word would say the lexicon of the war under the people activity of war with white males and their behavior. It's like, you know, like a prideful thing to know that I have done this and I'm continuing to do it because I know how important it is in order to maintain the system of racist white supremacy. But moving on to the next person.
All the other folks who had a hand up, line should be open. Do y'all have anything that stood out from second reading, second portion of text?
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Even with someone like this guy, you would think, I'm sorry, Mr. Chris Kyle, you would think he would be, I'm surprised there's no, maybe we'll get there later, that part where you revel in the terror of the person you're killing. I said, so are there white killers out there who just want to kill and don't get that visceral thrill of seeing the terror and the pain and the suffering? Because I'm not, none of that's in there, and I don't know if they're leaving it out deliberately because it's just talking about, you know, the killing. There's nothing in there about that joy of torture that we see so readily in everything else except for, you know, the protect and serve police officers. But, you know, they were just really loving the pummeling. But that's interesting. And then plus he's so disconnected. I mean, there is no attempt to put any humanity in this. You know this place is just, there's so many children running around. There's so many women running around. I mean, there's so many shopkeepers running around. People are screaming. They're yelling. They're crying. There's none of that in this. Everything is missing. It's been completely sterilized except for the killing. And that's I don't know if the rest of the book is going to be like that, but that's pretty phenomenal. I mean, that doesn't make for accepting it as end of reality.
Just going to get in really quick that I just, the audiobook flashed forward, unfortunately. So I think some of what we heard in the future in terms of the Punisher, which is basically a skull insignia that they, I guess his particular unit, that they would wear as a part of their garb, their military uniform. And he was describing how he wanted people to be afraid and to see their sign and to be like, yeah, we're tough. We're here and you're going to die. It sounded very much in the vein of kind of what you were talking about, that reveling and enjoying the people that you're killing, being afraid and in terror of you. It sounded, I don't know, and that was, you know, was disconnected, but just a little snippet that I heard sounded like some of that might be coming up down the road. But we'll have to wait and see. any of the other folks who dialed in, who had a hand up, did you all have anything that you wanted to comment on? Everyone?
Yes, can I be here?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I would like to say that this book is feeding into the propaganda, you know, of how the media portrayed this war in Iraq in the first place. They used the weapons of mass destruction as a way to enter into the country to take down a dictator that the United States had set up in the first place, because Saddam Hussein had been in cahoots with the CIA and they had set him up, you know, as a puppet leader. And then, just true to the nature, after they set these puppet dictators up, then when they get ready to bring them down, they need an excuse to go in. And so I think that at that time, Saddam Hussein did not want to go along with the OPEC on the oil prices, so he had to come down. And the book feeds into a lot of the media hype that was at that time that was disguising the whole meaning of the war and why we were going over there in the first place. And he makes it sound like a Western, you know, so to speak. They're going into war and he's almost meeting death and he's thinking about his loved one as he's facing death. And at the final minute, within 5 minutes of being killed, then the cavalry comes forth and saves them all and all that. It just sounds so phony. And the fact that he's trying to reveal and put down all the other nations, Germany and France, that they saw the names on the chemical barrels. Well, quite naturally, there was trade between other nations, you know, back when Saddam was in the good graces of all these white nations. But then, true to nature, when they get ready to bring him down, all of them was in cahoots in bringing him down. So it just goes to show you that, like you say, they come together like Voltron when they get ready to do something. They're all together as one. When it's a covert operation, and then when they get ready to cover the tracks, they all come back together again. So, and that part about seeing a guy literally with his ass blown off, you know, I think that they add in a comical component, you know, to that. So I'll mute my line and give somebody else a chance. Thanks.
Hello?
I have a question, good.
Yes, get your question. I heard the other person as well, but let's get your question.
Yes, right quick. Wasn't all of those different quote unquote countries were created by white people? Iran, Iraq, even the names, but specifically the governments, weren't they all created by white people? I.e. England and some others.
I think that that's correct in terms of them setting up the geographic borders that are going to define,
right,
you know, where this quote unquote nation is. And then, you know, as Mr. Demerfort was just saying, they at their own evidence has shown that they have been complicit frequently in whom is elected or who happens to be the person that is in charge in these areas as well. So absolutely.
The reason why I brought because I thought it was true. I just wanted to confirm it because I know you study history also. Is that, I mean, it's like it's kind of like, you know, in football, I may create a scenario to get a whole lot of practice. So I can get a whole lot of practice. Something I create, I can also destroy anytime I feel like it. I could dismantle it. I can manipulate it in any type of way that I want to manipulate it. The so-called leaders and whatnot. If just like the last caller was saying, as soon as that person transgresses against my orders, I can remove them and replace them with something else. You know, it's like playing. It's like playing in a serious sense. Of course, they are. But when we play, we would really be playing. You know, from a standpoint of not being centered on something direct and destructive, but even when they are playing, they have a talk about the races. They have a plan. They have an agenda, and whatnot. And I find it very interesting, especially when you study the history of war. Very interesting, the whole idea of all of those places that they're talking about, and they put place over the name of those places, the word terror. That they created all of them. Amazing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The other caller, I heard you speak up. Did you have something you wanted to get in as well?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I noticed the whole correlation between sports and war. And it brings me back to, like, watching lectures with Dr. Africa and how he says, if you watch sports while the TV's on mute, it's like watching military in motion. They get into huddles, they come out of huddles, run plays, and it's all about gaining an advantage on the other opponent. And just the whole theme in this recent reading today, you get that theme, like the whole brotherhood is us against them, and, you know, like the fight to the finish. And yeah. I mean, that's one of the main things I picked up on, is that whole sports being, that whole sports correlation being military in motion with these guys. And like, yeah, and they have their own little clique, and they call each other brothers. And that's how a lot of these guys in sports relate to themselves. They relate to themselves as brothers, but you know, that's another story for another day. But that doesn't appear to be when it comes to the non-white people when things happen to them on the sports field in the military. They don't get the backing of the white people when they're being mistreated. And that's about it. That's all I have for now. And it's an interesting read so far. Very interesting.
I concur. I genuinely wouldn't. This is not the normal type of fiction that I would race for, but I think Dr. Welsing and others encourage studying white people. This is definitely, I think, one that gives you great insight. I would be interested to hear Dr. Marimba Ani's thoughts on this. If somebody, you know, is in a talk or you see her, ask her thoughts, given what she's written. One of our listeners, she tweeted in, this disturbing book shows the disgusting, barbaric behavior of so-called heroes in their personal and professional lives. Well said. Some of the things I wanted to make sure I got in as well. We should have time for other folks to get in as well. The whole patriotism thing, oh my Lord, like that was... It was very Hollywood. Like people have been mentioned in some of the films that have come to mind just hearing all of this, and then they made it into a film and Jarhead and all that. That just everything about it, like the story that he had with it. Like, I mean, if I have been injured, I know I want medical attention. Like, I know this is not time for singing and medical attention, man. Like, what is that? Just everything about that just seemed very Hollywood and fabricated. Maybe it did happen, but it just, white people don't get the benefit of the doubt. But that whole portion when it came up, it was so fitting. The music that I had in the background of the introduction today was, the song Patriotism. Oh man, it's so fitting. They have Ronald Reagan sound clipped in the background, and I mean, it's just pointing out all of the hypocrisy of whites, who say they are coming in the name of democracy and civilization. It was so, so fitting. I didn't even know that he was going to have this big chunk on patriotism today. Also, let's see. It seems like the wanting to fight, the lusting to go and fight. It's, I mean, it's just, we've touched on that a lot. It reminded me of General Patton. I was going to play General Patton as the introduction. I was juggling to try to figure out whether I was going to do General Patton or go with the wife and her speech at the NRA. And I went with the NRA speech just because, you know, she's in the book. But I almost went with the speech at the beginning of the movie Patton. Mr. Fuller talks about this. He said this is so indicative of whites. But if you haven't seen the movie Patton, you should check it out. But it starts off, it's got this huge American flag in the background. It's just gigantic. And it's got Patton in front, and he's talking to the troops. And he basically, he says, all this talk about not wanting to fight is a bunch of nonsense. Like, every real American loves the sting of battle. I think he says something almost exactly like that. And I know he mentions Patton in the second section of the book. But I almost went with that audio clip. It's the same, that same sort of sentiment gets praised, just that worship of going out and killing, particularly killing black people, killing non-white people. It's just something that is to be revered, and they find different ways of packaging it and doling it out. But it's the same message, the same symbolism. Let's see, I thought, yeah, the ass blown off. I think Mr. Demery Four hit on that. I thought this sentence as well, and it reminds me of what his wife said. I thought she was being accurate last week when they met at the bar, and she was just like, "You're narcissistic. You're self-centered. You're all about just trying to show how tough you are and the whole nine." Like, I thought she was on the money accurate. And then when he comes back and he's talking about them being in this gun battle, and he says, "This is great. I fucking love it. It's nerve-wracking." And it's like it just, it seems like propaganda. Like, I think Karma had said that last week, that she feels like this book, the film, films like Jarhead, that sort of thing, that they're really, it's propaganda. It's like, yes, we're trying to recruit so that we can get more people to go out and be willing to tote a gun to practice racism and white supremacy. Like, it just, to me, it comes across strongly, it reeks strongly of being fantasy, just for the racist emotion. I was going to use Dr. Marimba Aini's term. Just wanted to make sure Uta Morojo being fulfilled in this book. Anything else that I had? Oh yeah, the part about the national anthem, where he says, "I've lived the literal meaning of the land of the free and the home of the brave. It's not corny for me. I feel it in my heart. I feel it in my chest. Even at a ball game, when someone talks during the anthem or doesn't take off his hat, it pisses me off. I'm not one to be quiet about it either. See, this is the sort of dangerous person where you were talking about. These folks are trained killers, and then you come back and try to integrate them into society. This is someone who's bragging about mauling other people. And yeah, I look forward to going to a bar because I'm a trained killer, and I know I'm going to be bumping into somebody that I can probably beat them down and kill them in the next 5 minutes. And this is a blast. This is fun. I love it. I love being able to go out and kill people. It's great. It's exciting. That this is the guy that's yelling, because that has been me. I have been at sporting contests and what have you, and they did the national anthem, and I don't get up. I don't sing. That's why am I going to participate in this? And people like Chris Kyle, they get very hostile, and they start cursing and the whole nine. Like, you can get really ugly. Psychopathic behavior being demonstrated. That stood out on a personal level for me. I'll hush so that other folks can get their comments in. Is anybody we missed, anybody who has not shared, who had a hand up?
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, that happened to me before too. I got cursed out for not participating, but actually I was a kid, and I went to I was big into wrestling, more white pathology. But my aunt, you know, she took me to a wrestling match, and I stood up for the Russian national anthem because I liked the Russian Nikolai Volkov and Irene Sheik, and man, they booed me. me. Grown men, I was about like 9 or 10. I mean, my aunt had to console me. It was horrible. But yeah, I remember that. And they, you know, stand for the Russian National Anthem. Everybody's supposed to boo. And, you know, I stood up because that was my favorite wrestler. And they just got me, man. But that's all I'm going to add. I'm in the store now.
Oh, right on, right on. Appreciate that. Appreciate that. That's more homoeroticism right there. White folks and their wrestling. That's another great example. Any of the other folks who dialed in with a hand up, your line should be open.
Hello? Speaking of...
Go ahead, ma'am.
Okay. Speaking of the skull insignia, that's the actual logo that's part of his company, Kraft International. So I found that interesting. And I think that at least two of his contractors were there during the Boston bombing. They were those that were wearing the backpacks with the private contractor gear on. And then the other, I had a question to pose to everyone. I'm someone that has worked around those law enforcement and in the military, and most of them, of course, have been white males. And I often hear them use the term brother and bro amongst each other, as the other caller mentioned, you know, it's used in the terminology used in sports. But when I first heard that used amongst white males, I immediately thought of them getting that from black men, you know, because I know that amongst our culture, we tend to use bro or say bro or sister or something like that. And I'm just wondering if anyone, is that something that whites have gotten from us? Because I first heard it used among other blacks. So I was just, that's just a question I have, because the white males, and it's almost exclusively been white males that have used that when I've been in that environment, and they'll actually use the term bro. So I was just wondering if anyone has ever heard that, or if, where they get that from. Do they get that from us?
They get everything from us.
If no one else is talking, I have a question also to ask. If I have permission to do so.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question. Did Jerry Jones open up his stadium for this person's funeral?
I'd have to look. Let's see. Let's see. He was a big icon down in Texas. That would seem fitting since he was a cowboy. I know his wife talked about.
Yes, he did. He did.
Yeah, because I actually read this story about this person before this book was written. I just have a habit of paying attention to the system of racist white supremacy and military actions. And this particular subject, you know, caught my eye. And he literally, for free, opened up this huge stadium. I mean, when this stadium opened, it became a worldwide attention. It was given worldwide attention, this stadium itself. I don't know the name of it, but I know it's in Dallas, Texas. Jerry Jones, you know, of course, is a billionaire. And he opened up this stadium for this person's funeral. I remember that. I don't stand up. I go to a lot of sporting events from being a coach a football coach since 1981. Go to a lot of ball games, and I don't stand up for the national anthem. And I actually have an attitude that I dare somebody to ask me about why I'm sitting down. Unfortunately, at a lot of sporting events that are primarily are upwards to 90% non-white black people, they stand up routinely also, which is not to be unexpected. But nevertheless, I've been to ball games such as the Florida Classic in the state of Florida, Orlando to be exact, where upwards to, at one point in time, there was something like 78,000 people at the stadium, and I would imagine at least about 99% of them were non-white black people. And they, quote-unquote, proudly stand up for the removal of their hats and the ball things, the Pledge of Allegiance, the pledge that's being made. I wonder if anybody is ever paying attention to that, on what you actually are saying in the pledge. But nevertheless, non-white people routinely stand up for this propaganda. It's kind of like co-signing, so to speak, in your demise. In a sense, it flashes in my mind. Anyway, I could be wrong, but it's almost like co-signing on it when you do that on a routine basis. I tell you one thing: if 70,000 non-white black people did not stand up, it would be a worldwide, it would be given worldwide attention. You know, but moving on. Anyway.
I have seen where one black person not participating in the Pledge of Allegiance can get worldwide attention. Folks,
the basketball player.
Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf. He played.
Yeah, the basketball player.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That got right ugly for a while. We pretty much did our 3 hours, unless somebody had a quick comment to the female caller's question about did they get that from us. I'm of the opinion that frequently when white people are doing that, they are either mocking or just trying to do a bad job mimicking black people and things that black people are stereotyped as saying and what have you. That's the impression that I get sometimes when white folks are doing it, particularly out here in Seattle. I get that impression heavily. That they like. I mean, they do it all the time in terms of stealing our free, even Black Lives Matter, stealing anything, everything. But I do get that impression frequently. That might not always be the case, but it frequently comes across to me that way, that they're either trying to imitate us or mocking us or all kind of at the same time.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I agree, yes.
That's nails on a chalkboard to me. I hate that. Like a white person doing that. Like that is about worse than calling me a nigger. Like, oh man, that a white person calling me bro. Like that is ruined day. Unless anybody had like a quick 30 second comment they needed to get in.
Yeah, you know, the ones that you work with, the ones that think they cool. And I find the most ones that do that calling you bro is Italians. The Italians love to, you know, after, you know, you have a little dialogue with them, you know, hey, bro, and then they do it kind of in a way, you know, holding their hands like a George Jefferson, like it's insulting. And I never let them get away with it, you know. I say something smart to them, and they usually, you know, cut that back. But, you know, yeah, I ain't your brother, man, you know, something like that. But, you know, we ain't cut from the same cloth. But, you know, that really eggs me, too. That ruins my day, too.
Absolutely.
I ignore it. It whatever is tagged with the statement with the word bro, whether it's a question or whatnot, I ignore the person, if it's a white person. Mm-hmm. Just totally ignore them.
Excellent. Yeah, I do not get down with any of that stuff. We should be in... tomorrow, the compensatory call-in, workplace racism, news and observations from the last 7 days. If folks have any tales of getting together over the so-called holidays that they want to share, if they were able to make it constructive or not, we can get that in as well. That'll be tomorrow. And then this Monday, we should have a white woman on the program. I think I'm going to actually take the 30 seconds to see if I can read her book title, because this is very interesting. This is a white woman, and I found her just because the paper, she did a review of James McBride, his book, The Good Lord Bird. And I think it's coming out as a film this year. I think I mentioned it on the review, but it should be coming out. Will and Jada Pinkett Smith's child should be in it. Jaden should be in it, playing the role of a slave who has to dress up like a female to try to escape. And it got a lot of attention. White people were just, you know, fawning over this book. It came out the summer of 2013. And I won all kinds of awards and all this. And Frederick Douglass is a drunk in this book. It's just it's standard operating procedure. But it's supposed to be coming out later this year. And the white woman that's coming on the program on Monday, she wrote a review, glowing review of this book, and talking about how great it is. And, oh, it's just wonderful. It's a barrel of laughs. And so she also wrote her own book. I thought I had it. This is, wait a minute. If I can pull it up, I'll tell you the title in case anybody wants to do any digging before she comes on the program to try to read a little bit of it. I don't think it's too big. Not getting it. If I can't find it in the next second or two, I'll just make sure I have it for the program for tomorrow, the title. But it's really interesting. I don't know how accurate she is. I haven't finished reading it yet, so I can't really comment on if she's being totally accurate and on point about racism, white supremacy throughout the book. But the subject matter, if nothing else, looked worth a read. Let's see. I got it. Okay. So the person's name is Baz Dreisinger, B-A-Z, Dreisinger, D-R-E-I-S-I-N-G-E-R. Baz Dreisinger, quite a name. But her book is Near Black, White to Black Passing in American Culture. That's the name of her book. The title again, Near Black, White to Black Passing in America Culture. Some of that might even be the white people calling you bruh might be a part of that. I thought it interesting subject. I'll be studying it for the weekend, and she'll be here on Monday. I always look forward to having white people, so look forward to that. But we'll be here tomorrow, 24 hours. Tune in. If you're going to go out, do any of that, codify. White people are going to be out full force this weekend because it's still New Year's and all that. I would encourage sobriety, but if you got to go out and do all that, get to one spot and stay there. That's my recommendation. With no white people present, you don't want to be spray painted and have them playing with your genitals, you know, when you can't defend yourself. But yeah, I would codify that. You do not want to get behind the wheel when you have consumed anything. It's one of the absolute worst possible decisions you can make under the system of racism, white supremacy. You're making the job for Daniel Pantaleo or Darren Wilson or Daniel Holtzclaw, you're making their job 1,000 times easier. So I would encourage sobriety. If you got to consume, codify. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Help us manifest maximum levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice as soon as possible. Context of white supremacy, signing out.
I'm a victim,
no
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.